The Economic Development and Housing Budget Division for January 26, 2010 will come to order. For those of you who are new here, who haven't been to the first two meetings, and I don't see a lot of new people, we are hearing bonding projects, and we won't be making any motions as far as formally moving the projects, but what we will be doing is laying them over for possible recommendation to Senator Langstaff's bonding committee. And so people will be coming in and out of the committee and hearing the bills. And then once this committee is adjourned, we will make some kind of recommendation to Senator Langstaff, and he'll take a look at the recommendation and figure out what he can include in his general bonding bill. So I'm going to go a little bit off the list. Since I'm the chair, I'm going to take my bill first, only because people are here from pretty far away and they need to get back up north. And so I think we'll start out with Senate File 1665, the Chisholm Sanitary Sewer District. If you guys could just come up to the table, just for a little bit of history for the record and for senators that are here. The Sanitary Sewer District was established in 2002, I believe was the correct year, and we've been going through the various planning stages and trying to figure out exactly how to get this thing done. At one point in time, Hibbing was in the district. Hibbing has since dropped out of the district, and so now we have Chisholm, Buell, Kinney, and Great Scott. And is Balkan still in? And Balkan's not in. So the plans have been pared down a little bit, and both Chisholm and Buell need new services. And the Chisholm sanitary sewer facility is actually falling apart. There's big holes in the wall, and they've been mandated to get more capacity and to fix their unit, any kind of further construction in town might be in jeopardy. And so these gentlemen have been working really hard with the Sanitary Sewer District trying to put everything together. And so what I'll do is I'll just turn this over to Mayor Craig Pulford from the City of Buell and to Norm Miranda, who's the Executive Director, and let you explain the particulars of this project and why we need to get it done and why it would really be nice to have some grant money. So who wants to go first?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Mayor Pulford, just say.
I was just introduce Mr. Central Iron Range. The details on it.
Money is our biggest issue. We don't have enough money to do this
out of our pocket.
We're charging pretty much right now.
And we need some kind of a plan so we can make it
user friendly
for us. Mr. Chairman, senators.
Say your name for the record, Norm.
Name's Norman Miranda. I'm the Executive Director of Central Iron Range Sanitary Sewer District. As Senator Tomassoni, Chairman Tomassoni pointed out, this initiative began in 2002, really in earnest in 2004, and we appreciate the bonding money that we received to go through the development and the planning stage. It's critical to starting out the initiative. The group of communities that makes up the district, we've been working very hard to come up with a plan that's workable. And without this project, I want to be clear that these member communities will lose their ability to provide basic wastewater treatment to their citizens. The project is not a luxury. It's something that is in dire need. The project will replace the existing facilities and demolish the existing facilities in Chisholm and Buell. These facilities are way over 30 years old. I think we've gotten more than our money out of them. They're dilapidated. The equipment is obsolete, and spare parts are non-existent. The concrete structures are crumbling away, so rehabilitation is not an alternative at this point. The new facility would provide a state-of-the-art facility with advanced treatment technologies that are required to meet the stringent requirements of the Great Lake Initiative and the binational agreement. They're some of the most stringent requirements in the state of Minnesota and throughout the country. And the technologies that are required here are typically technologies that you'd see in larger communities where you have a large customer base and a lot of money, a lot of folks to draw on to actually pay for these technologies. And we basically don't have that luxury. We're moving ahead. We're at 60% design of the facility just out of need because really in their current condition, we really have a threat of catastrophic failure at one or either of the facilities. So this facility is needed to meet the stringent requirements, basically for mercury reduction, phosphorus, and turbidity in the Great Lakes Basin. So that's the requirement. And it's also providing needed capacity, which the two facilities in question right now are basically running at capacity. The project would also provide, since we're putting infrastructure from Kinney to Buell and over to the new plant in Chisholm, it would provide wastewater treatment opportunities for the 169 corridor, which is a prime area for industrial and commercial growth in that area. As far as the current financial status of the project, we have local resources of $5 million. The project is a $13.4 million project, so we're looking for proceeds of $8.4 million for this project. And really, without this type of grant funding, this project is really going to become financially not feasible. Right now, the average community pays $27 just for sewage treatment. The debt service on, let's say this is would be a loan, the 8.4 would be in a loan form, that would add another $17 onto that particular fee. Over and beyond that, there'd be an annual operations and maintenance and replacement cost that would be tacked on the bill, which would be another $750,000 a year for operation and maintenance of the facility. And these communities also have in their discharge permits to do roughly $1.5 million in sewer rehabilitation annually to reduce their inflow infiltration into their collection systems and then out to the wastewater treatment plant. But all in all, it's a huge burden. The add to the average sewer rate would be exceed 100% citizens. I don't think I need to tell you what the economic condition is in northern Minnesota and the unemployment rate. So it's a huge percentage of the folks that are retired fixed income. So that type of funding would put an extreme burden and make the project tough to do. But I guess at the end of the day, this would do a lot of things. It would provide one central plan to put financial resources in to provide very pristine wastewater to the Great Lakes Basin on behalf of all of these communities. I think it's very unique that the communities are working together and trying to get this project done.
Thank you, Senator Mitzen.
Yeah, Mr. Miranda, thank you. I think you just hit something that's going to help your case a little bit about the infiltration and the water problems that if you don't do this, what this will create, and it's not just for Chisholm, but at the whole watershed, is it correct? And the pollution it could create in the whole area, not just this town, is that kind of right, or?
That's correct, Senator. Everything that happens in this ends up in the
Lake Superior
Basin.
Yes, I guess, Mr. Chairman, and sometimes not me so much, but the governor and some others talk about this special single issue thing like just Chisholm. But I think you going forward, a suggestion I think you should have is that this is bigger than Chisholm. This is pollution in our great waterway up there that Lake Superior and I think you should kind of push on that in that theme a little
and
bit.
You're correct, Senator Metzen. And in addition, it's a district. It's not just one city. It encompasses four different areas. And I think one of the things that's pretty neat about talking about the corridor, the development of the corridor, we actually have some mine pits along that corridor that are now full of water. And it could easily be a residential development area, and this could feed into it. And so, if any of you city slickers want to come up there and build houses on some of our edges of our pits, we'd love to have you. But they're very beautiful when you see them. But I think the issue becomes how much can each of the communities afford because of the amount of number of people that live there. And you mentioned $27 is the average. I know that my water bill is $27, and then my sewer bill is $48, and then there's a pond fee that's $19, and so it just keeps going on and on. And plus, you mentioned the other things. So I don't know, Mr. Coleman, do you have a handle on this thing as far as the PFA? You want to do it just real quickly, or you want to wait till you come up afterwards?
I think he's up.
Because we're kind of looking for a little bit of grant money too, not just loans.
In your packet, members, you should have a little packet from the PFA. And then there's several pages of green. Those are clean water needs list, and then the blue is drinking water. But Central Iron Range Sewer District's been more than 9 years. Got some funding to get it off the ground and get ready to go. I think there was some hope several years ago that Congress might appropriate some money, and there was authorization, so that kind of hurt. The affordability level changed drastically with Hibbing dropping out of it. A large population is cost to. So we're aware of high cost. We're proposing legislative changes to the wastewater infrastructure funding program, move it from a 20% loan to 4 years, and then payment from year 21 to year 40 to a grant program. EPA has given us permission to make loans up to 30 years for some of the high cost projects to spread the loan payments out. And we also, rather than looking at property value, looking at median household income, that's a better reflection of affordability. So we're proposing provide grant funding for communities. Once the sanitary sewer cost, operation, maintenance, debt service hit 1.4% of median household income on an annual basis, that we'll provide 80% grant funding for the construction cost.
They want to do replacement, not rehab.
We also put a $4 million on the sanitary sewer district would be eligible for a max grant. And then I think once the city's part of that district, they'd be paying over 1.4% median household income. To the collections would be a different project that hopefully, depending on the community, spread of the cost. Also be eligible $1 million. In Chisholm's case, we show about $980,000. With Chisholm's case, if they did it today, they wouldn't be eligible for any WIP. They can afford $980,000. Once they participate in the sanitary sewer district treatment costs, they won't be able to. Some assistance. So it's those kind of things we're looking at proposing. We'll be bringing that to the later in the session.
Okay. All right. Any further comments, Senator Sparks or Senator Metzen? Okay. I just want to emphasize that this is also taking two permits and moving it down to one permit, and two discharges and moving it down to one discharge, and basically taking an area of the Iron Range that needs and is mandated to fix up their sewer systems, and coming up with a solution that actually will work for a number of communities, as opposed to building new new treatment plants in two communities, and so we're trying to do it the most economical way and what seems to make the most sense. Neither one of you have any closing comments? Mayor?
Well, I have all kinds of comments, but we've all allowed city slickers up north to stay there to come across.
Do you have any comments on the bill?
Please, we really do need this funding. I can get on my knees and beg, but I don't think that would be appropriate at this time. But and I think it would be a good program for the whole northern Minnesota, this runoff of greater Minnesota area. I think it might be something that you're going to be facing in
too far away from the city.
Small communities that have plans that are going to be failing.
That would be a good model to start setting up for development
in the future for communities that need work.
Norm, anything else?
I guess that's pretty much it. We just, at the end of the day, again, I think that it's, you know, a lot of the projects I know that come before you, they're kind of, well, maybe this could wait or maybe that. And the reason we are on a fast track with this project and designing it is that, you know, at some point in time we have to do it regardless of what we get. It's just a matter of. So,
okay,
it's a matter of basic wastewater treatment.
We've got a couple of blanks on the bill, and we'll fill those in as soon as we get a quorum. And it's nothing you guys got to worry about. So
you can help.
No, well, I would like for you to have a vote if you want to know the truth. Thank you very much, and have a safe ride home. And I appreciate you guys coming down. And unless you're going to stay, are you staying tonight? I don't know if you're staying or not.
No.
Okay. All right. Okay. Thanks a lot.
How's the weather up there? Duluth got it pretty good.
3 inches ice on the roads. And
well, you better get back. And get
7 below. And the south part is okay, but the northern part is still. We got pounded.
Yeah, I blew out about a foot of snow yesterday morning at about 6 o'clock. So. Just to get started. So.
Really?
Yeah, it was ugly. So. All right. Okay, thank you both very much.
Appreciate your time.
And we'll lay this over for possible recommendation to the bonding committee. All right. Deed, agency bonding proposals. Who's got that?
And welcome to the committee, and you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members. My name is Mark Loftus. I'm the Director of Business and Community Development at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. I will describe the three components of the governor's capital budget proposal that will be coming forward, and Mr. Coleman will talk about the Public Utilities Authority specifically. The first element of our capital budget request is $25 million for the business development infrastructure program. And as you see in the information, we are proposing to combine the Greater Minnesota Infrastructure Program and science infrastructure.
That's just a document, the blue?
It's inside there, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And these are used as grants up to 50% to assist local governments, cities, counties, higher education institutions with infrastructure that will support job creation. And our projects are required to include a business activity, business job creation to support that. There's no speculative industrial park development here. These are all for projects that are related to a business development need. And as you look at the material, you see that the merger of the two programs is presented here. What we're trying to do is help us be more flexible in how we use infrastructure funds across the two programs. And it actually came to us, the idea came to us initially when we had more demand sort of infrastructure requests than we could fulfill. So it would have been helpful if we could use some of those funds that had been in the bioscience area, but we couldn't. So we are hopeful to be able to blend into a $25 million. Second governor's request will be $15 million for the redevelopment grant program. This is a program that helps remove old structures, dilapidated buildings in the middle of a city, usually, and allows us to tear those buildings down and invest in new infrastructure and support further development. It's been a very successful statewide program. Its impact, as we've had in the past year, across the state. The third project in the governor's request, unfortunately, is not on the paper here. We didn't think we put it on.
Can't have it then. No, go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. Okay, go ahead.
And it's $900,000 from a, which represents the remaining funds from a bonding allocation in 2006 for the County Road J interchange with 35W to help service the Medtronic project. That project was, I think, $14 million, and they had $900,000 left from the cost of the interchange development. So we're proposing to seek to use those funds for the Wright Street and Highway 6 bridge replacement, which is in desperate need of fixing and enhancing, primarily to serve the St. Jude Medical campus. They've been growing, and it's the primary access point for most of their employees. So this would help get that project done as well. So that's the third element of our request. So, Mr. Chairman, that's a quick summary. Happy to take any questions.
Senator Metzen.
Just on that intersection on 35 by Medtronics, is that the one where Medtronics kicked in a lot of money for?
Yes, they did, Mr. Chairman. Senator Metzen.
Which is a little unusual.
It was, and it's a good model for best in infrastructure.
Thank you.
I suppose you've probably heard some things about the merging of that first program as being a little controversial. Let me read it real quickly here. What do you have going as far as the disbursement of the money as far as what you're thinking between rural and metro?
Mr. Chairman, we're proposing that we be required to spend it up to at least 50% of that money in greater Minnesota. So we would expect probably more, at least 50.
Mr. Chair, the bill that's drafted and will be in the governor's binding bill that's released, I haven't seen it yet, also has not less than 50% of money in greater Minnesota. It also has 30% of the money targeted to bioscience projects. And if we can't get those funds under contract within 9 months of the fiscal year they're available in, we can call what isn't under contract back into the what used to be the Greater Minnesota Business Infrastructure Fund, but the Business Infrastructure Fund to do things other than bioscience. What we've found out in the past is the bioscience program tends to be a little slower, longer drawn out. But there's a lot of support for the concept, and we don't disagree with that concept. We don't have that many opportunities coming through our door every day like we do the infrastructure program. We also are looking at trying statewide, simply because my observation in the last 4 years is the governor's recommendation has always been trimmed back substantially by the time it got to conference committee. And the excuse always seems to be, at least publicly, it's the urban, so there's not a lot of support from the urban side. Part of our intent is to make it a statewide program, that debate or excuse for trimming when it comes time to trimming in conference committee. And to be honest, there is a need, substantial, yes, and the program designed for them, $250,000 to $500,000 grants. That doesn't mean a lot to a lot of communities in the metropolitan area, but there's still, you know, need to do the project. So.
And we had a bill here, Senator Scogin bill the other day that was the Minnesota Business Development Infrastructure Program for $20 million. And not considering the bioscience side of it, and there was some pretty vigorous testimony against merging the two funds. So I just want you both to know that there's there's two sides approaching this, and
bottom line is these programs generate a lot of private investment. They create a lot of jobs. And the last bond, 2 years ago, we literally got rid of the Greater Minnesota Business Infrastructure Funding Program. We have applications on a monthly basis. We have cities not to submit an application until they have their local match and any kind of business commitments to use the industrial park in place. We got rid of that money in 4 months. Almost all of it, $150,000 we got rid of in the fifth month. So that money goes fast.
I think the results of the 2006 are really, well, that's bio business, I guess. Let's see, the other one, the 2,000 jobs in 2003. So they're creating some big-time jobs just by putting in infrastructure, which is something we need really badly in this economy right now. So,
Mr. Chairman, could I add a point about the bioscience funds? The concern that's been expressed, to us is that if it's bioscience, we do a lot more bioscience projects, that will all go to the metro, because that's where bioscience projects are. But the fact is, in the sheet of projects that we have, 13 projects since 2006, 8 of those have been in greater Minnesota. You know, places like Austin and Worthington and Wilmer and Moorhead
and Cato.
Pine Island and Cato. So you take a look at where the projects actually go. Bioscience does occur in greater Minnesota, too. So if that's an issue of concern, I wanted to put that on the table.
I've heard that same concern about the bioscience projects, that rural Minnesota isn't suited for them. So.
Okay. They are.
Okay. All right. Any other comments from you gentlemen? Senator Metz.
We talk about, Mr. Chairman, the the money this money would leverage from the U.S. Government fund. Is there some money there available if we kick in? Or is that the PFA, which we're getting to? Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so I've been jumping ahead of myself, but I know that money's highly leveraged, Mr. Chairman, from the U.S. Environmental Fund. So.
Okay,
I'm ahead of myself. We'll get to that. Thank you.
So is this all Deeds requesting then?
Yeah, the capital budget, Mr. Chairman, yes.
Yeah, okay. Be two items for money, be some language on allow the transfer of that 900.
Okay. And what's the reason they didn't use the 900,000?
Chairman, I think the cost came below what they expected. So,
another indication it's really a good time for bonding, huh? Yeah, okay. All right. Anyway, okay, Mr. Coleman, you want to go next now? Or? Okay.
Chairman, in the packet you should have so this one page with the multicolored.
Okay.
Okay. So we're up here. PFA is requesting $30 to match. Government provides states capitalization grants for the states must come up with a $1 match for every $5 of federal funds. This program has been around since 1989. We made our first loan to the city of St. James in June of 1989. We have about $2.3 or $2.4 billion worth of loans made since that time. So it's been a very good program. These are historically have been loans. And the federal law has prohibited us from using the money for anything other than providing below market rate loans. So it's a 1-to-5 match. The $30 million, we anticipate receiving $150 million in federal funds. We take both the state and federal money. We lend that out along with our issuing revenue bonds and kind of blend all those. To provide below market interest rate loans. We have a minimum loan of 1%, so everybody pays some interest. And we do plan on at least doubling, if not tripling, that total amount. So if you're looking at $30 million in state, $150 of federal, that's $180 million. We expect to do between $380 and about $480 million worth of loans in the next 2 years out of this pot of money. The federal government in the appropriations bill this year told us we had to use 30% of that funds for principal forgiveness, so additional subsidy, because a lot of communities were complaining about affordability issues with loans, high-cost stuff. Minnesota is one of a handful of states that has state programs that help, the wastewater infrastructure program that we use to help high-cost projects. So it's kind of forcing other states to do the what we've been doing with state money, but giving them federal funds. So the language is kind of weird. After the first $1 billion of federal appropriation, 30% of the amount of money over that has to be in the form of principal forgiveness. So in Minnesota's case, we'll have about $5.6 million of the federal dollars on the wastewater side and about $6.6 million because there's no $1 million deduction. Just 30% of all the drinking water program has to be for additional principal forgiveness. So we need language in state law to allow us to do that. So we do have a bill that has a lot of things in it. Changing the wastewater.
Would that apply to the project we just heard?
Yes. Changing the WIF program. What we want to do is take those federal dollars that are required for principal forgiveness and use the same criteria for distributing that as we are proposing with WIF, so we can use the funds interchangeably, and they've got the same formula, so no one gets a better deal.
Now, are these stimulus dollars, or are these something
this
other?
This is regular annual appropriations.
And are there any stimulus dollars available for these projects?
We allocated the stimulus dollars. I think the last date was June 17th or something like that on the clean water side in July.
Already out the door.
On the drinking water, yes.
Any indication of anything new coming in?
There is a stimulus bill passed by the House that provides $1 billion for both drinking water and wastewater. And Minnesota gets about 1.7% of that. So we're talking $15-16 million. And up to half of that would be principal forgiveness if it passes. The Senate has a similar bill, but hasn't been passed out of committee yet and has not passed the Senate. They're scheduled to take that up in February. I don't know. I haven't heard any discussion of that since the Massachusetts election. It seems like people have different attitude in Washington with change of one seat, but we'll see what happens. I just want to that's those programs. They do have a PFA bill that's going to address some of the changes in federal law as well as our recommendations for WIF. The wastewater infrastructure funding program, you just heard communities presenting the case. This program has been around for years. It's called, in essence, called supplemental assistance. It's to supplement other funding programs. In the WIF case, the two programs that it supplements are USDA Rural Development, which is a federal agency that provides loan grants to rural communities. We provide, when they calculate a grant need for a community, they look at operation maintenance cost and then an affordability. They use 1.5% median household income and then provide 100% of the cost over that. We match their, if they say a project needs $1 million grants, we put 65% state funds into it and they put 35%. And that formula we've been doing now for several years. It helps them spend their loan money because they get a lot more loan money than they do grant. So by us matching the grant 65-35, they're able to get rid of all their loan dollars. Otherwise, they go back to Washington. And we like to keep federal dollars in the state. So we've put in a little extra. It used to be 50-50 years ago. And I think about 4 years ago, we changed it to 65 when the Bush administration decided to appropriate the same dollar amount but trim back the grants, increase the loan, because loans are equivalent of $13 for every $1 of grant. So in essence, the program got cut drastically, but on the books it looked the same. And the other way to match it is through the state revolving loan fund. Once it hits a certain threshold, we historically have used 5% of the median or market value as debt, and then we've provided 0% loans payable in year 21 with that. The stimulus dollars we got last year showed us that if we provide grant funds, the demand is pretty substantial, and a lot more cities qualify than they did under the household or the market value property. So we're recommending a change in that program. And the $20 million that the governor is recommending go a long ways to addressing a lot of these high-cost projects. So.
Okay.
Thank you.
If anybody has any questions on the list, I'd gladly give me a call and I'll gladly talk on
What are you anticipating? How far down the list are you anticipating funding?
Our target is to go down to, on the clean water side, 45 points. And if you look on the green sheet, the points are the second or the third column, PCA.
How much do you have in requests total?
If we funded 100%, and not 100% of these projects go, we'd probably need about $90 million to cover all the way down to 45 points. We'll be making loans all the way down to 45 points. And the amount of supplemental assistance, depending on which projects move forward, we'll go in rank order. In each fiscal year, we change that, modify that list. So if the bonding bill passes early this session, we'll be using this list, because this is the one good for this fiscal year. We probably anticipate another 50 projects being added to it come July. And we don't know where they'd fall, but we would continue to go down that list.
And on the blue sheet, how far on that one?
The blue sheet is the drinking water program, and we're so under-leveraged on that one because the demand has not been great. Yet nationally, drinking water is a big issue. So we get a lot of drinking water money. So we'll do everything. If they're ready to go, we can afford to go to the bond market and bond for whatever is ready. So I think the last time we sold bonds for the drinking water program was in 2005. So we've built up a lot of capacity.
So you can handle the whole list on the blue?
If they're ready to go.
Okay. All right. Okay. Any questions from the...
Provided we get the state match.
Okay. And how much is it, the state match?
$30 million total is we're asking, and it's kind of split between drinking water and wastewater in the budget, but it really depends on the actual dollar amount Congress appropriates. Based on Obama's budget, this is what we need.
Remind me what the governor requested.
The governor recommended $30 million, which was our recommendation based on the president's budget.
Okay. Well, $30 million though is for the...
The state match.
State match.
$20 million is the governor's recommendation for the wastewater infrastructure program, plus $400,000 in general fund money to cover the administrative cost. And most of that goes to PCA because this program is fairly intensive when it comes to helping cities look at projects and trying to keep these costs down and get through the permit process.
What if they don't get the general fund money?
We would accept bond dollars for some of it, but it really limits the amount of it eliminates the technical assistance side that we have used general fund money for, but it still would cover the plan and spec review and things like that. So we'll take whatever we can get.
Bond dollars aren't eligible for that part of it?
Bond dollars can't be used for technical assistance. They can be used for the plan and spec review and things like that, but it's just... Yeah.
Okay.
We'll take anything we can get, Mr. Chair.
Okay. We'll do our best. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Yeah. Minnesota Historical Society. We don't have any authors here, do we? Buongiorno.
Buongiorno. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Nina Archibald, and I'm director of Minnesota Historical Society. And working with me today will be Michael Fox, who is the Society's deputy director for program. And he's passing around some notebooks that we hope you will find informative. Basically, you'll find in your folders that you have today a printout of our presentation, a brochure that looks like this about the Oliver H. Kelly Farm, which is a centerpiece of our proposal, and also you will find a summary of our capital budget request that looks like this. So you might want to follow along. Anyhow, what we're going to do this morning is, or afternoon, is to talk about the three elements of our capital budget request: asset preservation at $6.713 million, improvements to the Oliver H. Kelly Farm for $9,857,000. and capital grants for historic preservation projects around the state that would be eligible for bond funding, and this amounts to $1.5 million. This last, I must say, has been a grant program we've been running since 1994, and you have appropriated dollars for it each year. So, Michael, I'm going to turn to you right away and ask that you talk about our asset preservation request, which is always our top priority.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Fox. I'm the Society's Deputy Director for Programs. And as Nina said, I'm going to quickly go through the asset preservation third of our request. As you're probably well aware, the Society maintains over 120 historic structures as part of our historic sites network. And in Minnesota's climate, this is always a challenge to keep these buildings available for interpretation of Minnesota's past. You have in your list, in your slide printout, a list of nine projects that are given in our priority order. And let me go quickly very through, and you will see some illustrations of a number of these projects. The first one is the rehabilitation of the Ayers House at the Mille Lacs Indian Museum and Trading Post. This is a structure that dates back to the 1920s, is associated with Henry and Jeanette Ayers, who ran the trading post. It needs a new roof. It does not have operable plumbing, and we need to rehab it to use for group educational programs. The next area is historic Fort Snelling. Both the preservation of the 1819 historic fort and the structures, but also for the preventive work on the 1914 Cavalry Barracks buildings 17 and 18. In the slide, you see there is a sidewalk that goes past the building. It's now enclosed in a chain link fence because we have slate tiles falling off the roof, and they are unfortunately projectiles. The next area is the series of projects across the network to improve our HVAC and also increase the energy efficiency of the systems that we have. In your slides, you have a picture first of a rehabilitation at the Ramsey House that was done with $2,008 dollars. Then a picture of the 35-year-old heating plant at the Hill House, extremely inefficient. We're looking for greater fuel efficiency and savings on these. And then also a project at the Fort Ridgely where we would intend to add some insulation to the ceiling. The next illustration is the grain elevators at Mill City Museum. When Mill City, when the A Mill was rehabilitated and Mill City Museum was built, we did not have funds to rehab and stabilize the adjacent grain elevators, which are certainly part, an iconic image of Minnesota's agriculture and food processing industries. We need to do some concrete stabilization there. At historic Fort Snelling, or Fort Ridgely, rather, we have a need for some masonry repairs and roof repairs, as well as the insulation that we showed you in an earlier slide. The Forest History Center presents particular challenges. These buildings were not intended to be permanent. Logging camps, by their nature, were transient. They were meant to be there for 1 year. And the buildings have what our conservators would call inherent vice. That is to say, the structure and the materials used were not intended to be permanent. And you can see in another illustration what happens with the typical Minnesota winter. We also propose to rehabilitate approximately 12 historic sites and markers around the state. The one shown here is for Wood Lake Battlefield, which was the important conclusion of the 1862 U.S.-Dakota War. The following slide is of obviously of Split Rock Lighthouse, which will celebrate its centennial this year. We are proposing, and there is an insert in there of the lighthouse actually under construction. We will be rebuilding an historic barn that was burned for use as an educational facility. That concludes the list of the nine asset preservation projects that are our priorities. And I turn it back to Nina to talk about the Kelly Farm Revitalization Project.
In your slide, you have $6.7 million. That's the Split Rock Lighthouse, right?
That's for all of these asset preservation projects.
That's the total?
Yes,
that is
Mr.
the total.
Okay. And the Split Rock Lighthouse is $1.4 million.
Is that the specific amount in that? You should see that on the summary.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Because it's kind of fun. Isn't that the place where they built the lighthouse? They built three buildings for $75,000 back when they first, isn't that?
Mr. Chairman, your memory is better than mine, but it's highly likely that that is the case.
Okay, then it is the case.
But not for me.
Don't argue with the chair.
No. Yes, don't worry.
Mr. That was before they even had roads. They were bringing it up by boat.
That is true, no. Mr. Chair.
Okay. All right.
Shall we proceed?
Yes,
if there are any questions.
Proceed.
Yeah, the
let's
next part of the presentation is about the Kelly Farm, and this is an exciting part. This is really, as I said, the sort of centerpiece of our request this year.
Is that the place where they got like the bomb shelter when you walk in?
That would be, Mr. Chairman, yeah, the place that looks rather like a bomb shelter.
Right.
We have a couple of those, actually.
Okay, all right.
This one happens to be up near Elk River on Highway 10. And as I said, you can look at the brochure and really follow along and enjoy some of the images from the site. I want to begin by thanking the committee for an appropriation that we received in 2008, which provided $300,000 for pre-design and design to remodel and to expand the visitor center that is there, the bomb shelter, as our chairman referred.
Okay.
We now return to you for funding to help us complete the project with a request of $9.857 million. I should note that this particular historic site is a National Historic Landmark, which is the highest designation which the federal government gives to our historic sites around the nation, and it is located very close, of course, to the Twin Cities, although it's on the edge there in the Elk River. It's really a significant state resource in an area of intense development. If you've been up Highway 10 recently, you know what the level of development along Highway 10 and in that area stretching from north of Minneapolis. It's intense. And to have a farm in that location is an enormously precious resource. The Society has a deep commitment to preservation and to teaching at the Oliver Kelly Farm. That land at the Kelly Farm has been farmed continuously since the 19th century when Kelly actually ran the farm. We opened it to the public when we acquired it in the 1980s. We've been farming there. If you've been there, you know that we use 19th century farm techniques. We farm with oxen. We use machinery operated by real horsepower, and we grow crops and varieties, and we prepare food as they would have in the 19th century. It's very much a step into the past. The site is incredibly popular with schools and with families. There is, however, an emerging, troubling experience that we are having at the Kelly Farm. It has to do not with us or even so much with our buildings, but it has to do with our visitors. Many of our visitors, especially children, have no idea of where their food comes from. It comes from Cub Foods, and beyond that, they pretty much don't have a clue. I can tell you when I came to Minnesota a long time ago, Mr. Chair, the people I met in graduate school here had all grown up on farms, or they'd grown up on the Iron Range. They'd grown up in rural Minnesota. They were very connected to the land and to the industries of this state. Today, less than 2% of our state's people actually are living on farms. And yet it is our state's second largest industry. It's very, very important to us and to our state.
You know, Ms. Archibald, I asked my 100-year-old aunt, I asked her what she did when she was a little kid, and she looked at me and she said, 7 o'clock every morning I used to deliver milk from the 7th Street South all the way to 5th Street North in Chisholm. And I said, so you had cows in the barn on the 7th Street South? And she said, yes, we did. And I looked at her and I said, pasteurization? She said, no pasteurization. I think that's what's wrong with these kids nowadays.
Well, Mr. Chair, as an aside, I can tell you that I've made a commitment to enter a milking contest at the state farm next year with the society team. I think I need to start practicing soon. I have never milked a cow.
No, don't embarrass yourself.
Okay, don't worry. That's probably very good advice. Anyhow, what we propose to do is to develop facilities to tell the much bigger story. Certainly we're going to continue telling the story of farming in the 19th century, but what we're going to try to do is to connect kids with agriculture and with the food that they eat today. So we want to connect Minnesota's people with agriculture today, and we have an ideal location, I think, to do it, a land farm that was been continuously farmed and a farm that is located within 40 minutes or so of 2.5 million people who live here within the metro area. What we're talking then about is broadening the focus of the farms program. We began all this not just with some crazy ideas in our own heads. The kids gave us the clues, but we started by meetings with stakeholders. And I have to say that Commissioner Gene Hugeson, the Department of Agriculture, called an early meeting, and he called together all kinds of stakeholders from the Farmers Union to the Farm Bureau to the State of Minnesota Agriculture, a education program and talked to us about what we could do at the farm. It became absolutely clear that the Society needed to develop a program and facilities to support a deeper understanding of agriculture in our history, which would lead right up to today. The watchword for our effort is sustainability and care for our land, which is so precious. We want to make the best possible use of the resources that we have there, the acreage that is so precious. We're going to expand the visitor center. We're not going to tear it down. Yes, it's a bunker, but we're going to do our best with our bunker. It's our bunker. We're going to be adding to it. We're going to add classrooms. We are going to add a teaching kitchen, and we're going to add basic staff and visitor amenities, which we don't have there. The brochure actually will give you the lay of the land, and if you open it up, if you haven't done that, you can do that, and you'll see that it is a map. And the existing visitor center in the large, if you look at the inset, which is down in the lower left of the brochure, what you'll see is that the existing visitor center is shown in off-white color, and the new construction is in brown, both the addition to the existing building and some new outbuildings, a greenhouse, a multipurpose shelter, which is essentially a fancy word for a picnic shelter, a maintenance building, because after dark and when the kids go home, we do a little farming with equipment, animal husbandry building. We have livestock there, which need care, and we have a guest animal shelter. This is kind of Motel 6 for guest animals, and I'll explain to you why we have guest animals at the farm. The building has been designed, thanks to your support. It's ready to go, designed by Paul Anderson of Partners in Cerny. Any of you who've been up to Itasca recently may have visited the Mary Gibbs Center, which is up there, and you will know that it is a very, very, very fine building, and so that was very much the basis on which we chose Paul Anderson. Our charge to him was to give us a design to support our educational mission, but also to be a really wise steward of the resources that we have there. The project is nearly shovel-ready. The general layout of the land supports the continuation of the 19th century farm program. That'll stay. If you look at the larger picture, what you see is the river here. You see Highway 10 over here. Everything that is to the southwest of between the existing visitor center and the river will stay pretty much as it is, and we'll continue to do 19th century farming there. On the other side of the visitor center, we'll be moving into the 20th century.
Ms. Archibald, what does nearly shovel-ready mean?
Nearly shovel-ready, Bob, means how far along are we on the drawings? Who's got?
Schematic.
We're through schematic design. We are in the process of design development, construction drawings, I think. Mr. Chair, I think we would be ready to go in late summer, early fall, but I will get back to you with the specifics on that so you'll know exactly how ready we are to begin. What we propose to do, if you can imagine the two parts that I've described, one side on the that is toward Highway 10, the other side, which is toward the river, our plan is that we're going to continue to grow our King Philip corn in the 19th century area. That's a 19th century variety, of course. But we're going to grow sample plots of today's 20th and 21st century highly hybridized demonstrations of corn as it's grown today. I talked about the animal shelter. We do have animals on the site today. They are animals that look a little different from the animals you would see on a modern farm. They are backbred animals. We're using oxen. We're using we have different varieties of sheep and swine than you would see on a contemporary farm. So our plan is to continue to have these backbred animals in the 19th century part of the farm, but to have guest animals that would be lent to us by area farmers who would show you how these animals in the 19th century part of the farm compare to the animals that are on modern farms today. And, of course, the machinery is hugely different. We'll continue to do our work with oxen, to plow with oxen instead of with plow with modern tractors. We will continue to do horse-powered threshing, much as they did it in the 19th century, and we will have modern equipment out that would represent how this work is done and the tremendous efficiencies there are in farming today. To do this, we're not going to be buying animals, other modern animals. We're not going to be buying modern farm equipment, but we have sufficient relationships at this point with neighboring farms and farmers who are willing to lend to us so we can run a program of this kind. Our hope is really ultimately to connect and reconnect, is what it amounts to, Minnesotans with their farms and farming to educate them that will, in ways that will help them to make wise decisions about their health, about our economy, and about our environment. There are many, many questions today about the food we eat. We know that. Radiated, is it good? Is it good to have genetically enhanced or genetically changed food? How do we get all these E. coli breakouts? What does that really mean? And I think we've got a really good place to address these kinds of questions as well as to connect people back to the land.
Okay.
Chair, that completes my presentation.
And your request is in order of what you prefer. If you could get the historic site assets preservation and that's all you could get, that would be what you would want.
Yes, Mr. Chair, okay. We would hope we would do better than that, but our intent is to take good care of what we have. That's the most essential thing that we have. Okay. There is one final piece of the request, and that concerns the money that we regrant to others through the bonding bill, which I said we had done since 1994, and Michael had just a few things to say about that with your permission, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Fox.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I turn your attention to the slides at the end of the package. They refer to the county and local historic preservation grants. The request is for $1.5 million, which is the amount that we received in the 2008 session. As Nina mentioned, this program has been in every bonding bill since 1994, and it provides county local governments with grants to preserve and continue to use important historic structures in their communities. Examples of these are shown in three slides. The library in Stevens County, in Morris, which is in Stevens County, the Near Strand City Hall, and the Washington County Courthouse. Last year, we appropriated handled about 20 projects statewide with these funds.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Metzen.
Yeah, one thing I think, Sergeant Ball, that I think is important on this Kelly Farm is that there's over 6,000 feet on the Mississippi River. And as far as I know, they're not making any more rivers. And I think that's an enhancement to this project, too. And you didn't really mention that, but looks like 6,500 feet on the Mississippi River.
Senator Metzen, Mr. Chairman, that's an incredible resource that we have, and we actually do use it even today. We've been doing prairie restoration. We're going to restore an oak savanna that's there, and we do have a vehicle that we're able, horse-drawn vehicle, that we're able to take guests on a trail that takes them very close to the Mississippi River. So that river is very much a piece of what is a fabulous resource for the state.
That's what I saw in this presentation. That's pretty important.
Indeed it is.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Final comments?
No, Mr. Chairman. That concludes our presentation. We appreciate the opportunity.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
we'll
you.
Lay this over for possible recommendation to the bonding committee. This is the Housing Finance Agency.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Welcome to the committee, Ms.
Thank you. I'm Tanya Orr with the Housing Finance Agency. I know that you have a very full agenda, and at least some of you participated in some of the capital investment tours related to our bonding requests, so I will be brief and hopefully rewarded for being brief.
No guarantees on that.
But you can't blame me for trying, right?
That was a good try.
The Housing Finance Agency made several bonding requests. The governor has recommended $5 million in nonprofit housing bonds for the requests related to foreclosure recovery and supportive housing. As I'm sure you all are aware, we still are in the midst of a foreclosure crisis. There are attached to your handouts a map about where foreclosures are occurring in the state of Minnesota, and you can see that they really are occurring all over the state. There are also, as examples, two maps, a map of Minneapolis and a map of St. Paul, showing where foreclosures have occurred in those two communities. And the point of those two maps is that we are seeing concentrations of foreclosures in particular neighborhoods. This is really devastating to neighborhoods. Not only are individuals losing their homes, but you have then several homes on a block and blocks where you have a lot of vacant and foreclosed properties, which is not good for the neighborhood. It's not good for property values, not to mention being good for the families who have lost their housing. So our bonding request related to foreclosure recovery is for the authorization for the agency to issue nonprofit housing bonds where the state would appropriate the debt service. And we would use those for the purchase and rehabilitation of rental housing to be owned and operated by nonprofit organizations, owned for and operated for at least 20 years as affordable housing. By paying for the acquisition and rehab costs, it should mean that the rents are equivalent to the operating costs, which will mean that we'll have affordable rents. So we'll put housing back into the housing stock and also provide additional affordable housing that may not exist in the future without this help. We're also asking that some of the money be used for supportive housing. As you know, we started a plan to end long-term homelessness in 2004. We have made progress and met our goals every year until 2009. But we still we have a goal of 4,000 housing opportunities. We have funded over 2,600. We've got over 1,700 people housed in these units already. And we would like to continue to make progress towards that goal of 4,000 opportunities. The governor's recommendation is for, as I said, to authorize $5 million in nonprofit housing bonds. The debt service on that is estimated to be $400,000 each year. That would be a general fund appropriation.
Ms. Orr, I know Senator Sieben had a $5 million bill for land trusts. Does that fit into this $5 million anyway that the governor's recommending?
Mr. Chair, it does not. We did submit a request for $2.5 million for land trusts, and the governor chose not to fund that.
Okay.
We also had a request for public housing, which is also not part of the governor's recommendations. And I think you were on the tour at Albert Lea. Senator Sparks, who was here, was there as well.
All these dots on here, are any of them getting funded without public help?
Mr. Chair, there is some investment by the private sector. What we're concerned about in the investment for the private sector is that the private sector does not have the same requirements in terms of the rehabilitation that needs to be done, and is not necessarily looking to have a long-term investment in the community. But most of the work that's getting done in these neighborhoods is done through the federal Neighborhood Stabilization Program, through other resources the agency has made available over the last couple of years, local financing, philanthropic financing as well.
And how is federal stimulus money fitting in anywhere along the way here?
The state has received, Mr. Chair, $58.8 million in federal NSP 1, Neighborhood Stabilization Program 1. And last week, I think it was, the HUD announced another $19 million for the consortium of Minneapolis, Brooklyn Park, and Hennepin County, and $18 million for St. Paul. They haven't gotten it yet, so they just were awarded it. The NSP dollars, the state received $38.8 million of that. We allocated it to various jurisdictions, and we've committed over a third of the money already.
And is it for rehabbing homes, or is it for fixing these mortgages, or what?
It's all for acquisition, rehab, some demolition, although we really limited the money that the state got for demolition, down payment assistance. It's not to modify the mortgages.
Okay. And how about tax credits?
Tax credits are used for rental housing, and the federal government, as part of the stimulus package, did provide some additional support for the tax credit program because of the profit because companies are not making the sort of profits that they used to, there's not as much demand for tax credits. The prices have dropped dramatically from like 95 cents on the dollar down to sometimes as low as 60 cents on the dollar, which means the financing gap is bigger. The federal government, as part of the stimulus package, did provide both a tax credit assistance program and an exchange program. That has filled all of the gap for 08, 09, and part of 10. We're hoping that the federal government will extend the parts of the tax credit assistance program or the exchange program to continue because the tax credit market isn't back. But we have been able to get the tax credit projects that were stalled going because of the federal assistance.
Okay. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Metz.
Thank you. I see in a nonprofit, will the housing bond request priorities will be looked at along transit corridors? What's the definition of a transit corridor?
Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen, it is, I can describe it. It's like the Central Corridor, the Southwest Corridor, but also transit corridors in our metropolitan area can mean major transit ways, so where there's a park and ride and things like that. Does that make sense? So we're looking for ways for people to get inexpensively and quickly from their home to their jobs. So we're really trying more and more to make sure that the housing that the state finances facilitates people getting easily and inexpensively to work.
Chairman, we don't have our Robert Street corridor yet funded, so.
Is that a plug?
Yes.
Well, that's a good point, I think, to get people near transportation.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I know I was at a disability meeting up in the Iron Range, and many of the people that are in the disabled community that are working, one of their problems is transportation. And that's one of the things that they were complaining about because they had to ride the bus for so long that it actually took up a lot of their money that they were earning. And so to try and get them near transportation to get them to work is a good thing. So. Get people going. Senator Kielash.
Yes. I was at the Keith Ellison HUD hearing on Saturday, and one of the things that came up was the limitations on NSP dollars. Could you describe what those limitations are and the pitfalls that seem to be a problem for getting it distributed?
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash. One of the biggest problems that most of the grantees or awardees are finding is that there is a prohibition on contingent offers, essentially, because under the NSP dollars run through the Community Development Block Grant Program, and those underlying rules require that that you have an environmental review and an appraisal before you make a final purchase offer or what HUD calls a choice-limiting activity, which is really interesting language. And so what that means is that you can't make an offer on a house and then say pending an appraisal and an environmental. But if you wait for the appraisal and the environmental review, somebody else has come in and bid ahead of you. So cities are very frustrated about the fact that they're not able to acquire properties because they have to go through some hoops that private investors don't have to go through. So we're not able to do the contingent offers. So what it means is that we're seeing that the rehab costs under the NSP program are going up because the properties that we're able to acquire are the less desirable ones because the private investors are going in and able to offer cash. So we don't have to go through the FHA. The buyer isn't going through the FHA loan processing, which takes 30 days, or having to go through this appraisal and environmental review, which we think are good things to do. We would just like to switch the timing, allow us to make the offers contingent on the environmental review coming back and the appraisal coming back. And then if they don't, we substitute other money for the NSP. So we think there's an easy solution to the problem, but it's been a huge delay.
Thank you.
Ms. Soares, is there anything the state can do to bridge the delay until the HUD dollars or the NSP funds come?
Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, the only thing which some communities are doing is just trying to use other money, if they have other money, and not use the NSP money for acquisition rehab. Communities don't have enough money to really do that. So we will be submitting language to Representative Ellison about a fix, and we would appreciate the Senate's support on urging that fix.
Thank you.
Any other comments, Senator Vanderveer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a private investor is going to purchase the property in any way, why do you want to get around? Wouldn't you want to deal with properties that weren't going to be dealt with?
Mr. Chair, Senator Vanderveer, in certain circumstances, we certainly would. The concern that and the experience of communities is that we're seeing another type of investor who's making a short-term investment in the property and is not sort of in there for the long-haul stabilization of the community. And so they'll do a minimum amount of rehab to bring it up to whatever, you know, minimum standards. They're not going to stay at the property and be a good landlord for very long at all. Their goal is to invest in the property when the market's low, sell it as soon as they can make a profit. In the meantime, they haven't fixed the problems of the house. They're mostly doing cosmetic things. These communities where there are the clusters of black dots on the maps, these communities need to have their housing stock stabilized, and they need to have more than a minimal investment if they're going to have a long-term if we're going to have a long-term stabilization of the community. So that's not every investor, that's certainly not true with every investor, but communities have experienced that. And that's why we need to we would like to have the public sector and the private sector be on a similar footing.
Follow up? Okay. Any further comments or questions? Any closing comments? Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Senator Lori, are you here?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee. Which one do you want to take first?
Let's do the Carlton County first, and we're going to dig out a handout if somebody wants to come and distribute that for us. And the Carlton County project is a community services building project, and I've been instructed by staff and will be very cognizant of your time limitation, so I'll be very brief here and just say that this is really an effort to combine what occurs right now in four different locations: County Health and Human Service Operations for Carlton County, Veteran Services, Minnesota Workforce Center, and Minnesota Motor Vehicle Licensing. They're all occurring in separate locations, and each of those buildings has a set of issues. This will allow for consolidation of these state and local government agencies and allow for one-stop shopping for constituents and allow for greater collaboration among the entities being served here, too, with the potential of cost savings as well. With me here today to help present is Michael Stafford, the Facilities Director for Carlton County, Marv Bodie, the Chair of the Carlton County Board, and Dave Lee, the Director of Public Health and Human Services.
Who wants to go first? Whoever goes first, just say your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll go first, I guess. My name is Mike Stafford, Facilities Director for Carlton County. I want to thank the committee, first of all, for allowing us this opportunity to address you. Thanks, Senator Lurie, for his support of this project. As the Senator has mentioned, what we're looking to do here is combine services that are now spread throughout a number of different facilities, all of them inadequate in various ways, into one general service center that will help us with efficiencies. As it currently exists, our veteran services are provided out of the county courthouse in Carlton. Our public health and human services are spread over two separate buildings in the city of Cloquet. Workforce Center is at a third building in downtown Cloquet, so it does not lend itself to efficient service to clients. That would be bad enough, but these individual buildings, each of them have their own issues. In our, for example, our vet service office, quite small. It has no provisions for privacy, so when vets come in and are meeting with one of the officers and discussing private medical data, other vets have to wait in the hallway. We have no way to sequester that interview. Public health is presently in an old oil warehouse. It's got very inadequate clinic space. We have clinics taking place hallways. We have others with infants having to wait in hallways. We have inadequate conference space up in the attic. We have meeting rooms taking place in underneath air handling equipment and no storage. The Human Services building is currently in an old grocery store that was built in the 50s, which we've used since the 70s. It has inadequate space, a number of maintenance issues. And the Workforce Center, as I mentioned, is across the city of Cloquet from our Human Services. So when clients need a service, need to obtain a service at Human Services and then go immediately to the Workforce Center, there's a difficulty in them getting there immediately, and sometimes they get lost on the way. What we're looking to do, as we said, is combine all those services into one building. We're currently developing this project in partnership with the city of Cloquet. The building will be constructed on various parcels in downtown Cloquet, some of which the city is acquiring, some of which the county has acquired. We've been planning this process for 2 years. It's been carefully designed based on a number of premises. One is, first and foremost, is effective service delivery and meeting clients' needs. We're trying to make it as convenient and flexible as possible. We want it to be technologically very flexible, so as things change as we go down the road, we can adapt it quickly and easily as they come up. We're looking to design, the building is designed as a LEED certified building. It will be at least a silver level LEED certified building when we're done. And I think as you can see, I'm not going to go through this brochure with you page by page, but I think you can see the current state of the facilities as well as the design of the new building in the back. The current status of the project is that we've basically design is complete through construction documents. We are in final stages, or the city of Cloquet is in final stages of property acquisition. We're looking to begin construction early this summer. This project is absolutely ready to go. It will be a 40,000 square foot building. Estimated cost is $9.6 million. We're pursuing funding from a variety of sources, as well as this request to the state for bonding assistance. We feel that it will have a direct and immediate economic impact in our county. As most of you know, construction trades unemployment is running in excess of 20% in northeastern Minnesota. This project, once it begins, will employ up to 200 individuals for 18 to 24 months. So that will have a significant immediate impact in our county and hopefully keep these people working long enough for other projects to come along. Right now, there's a real dearth of any projects going on in our area. And, of course, the great fear is the longer people go without work, they're going to have to move. And if they move, they're not coming back. So we see this as a very timely project from that perspective. With that, I will turn it over to Dave Lee, who can discuss with you a little more directly the service impact.
I kind of like this picture right here where you got the sink and the files side by side and the fire extinguisher.
Everybody's office should look that good.
That's a pretty good one.
That way, if the files do catch fire, we're ready.
You can put them all. Now, which building is that one in?
That's in the main Human Services building.
Okay. And what upon construction and finishing construction, what are you going to do with the other buildings?
One will be sold. One will be torn down as part of this project when we come to the new parking lot.
Okay.
Senator Lurie, I think you ought to get the code enforcement people out here and look at these buildings.
not just yet.
It's another couple months.
I think you get crowds to, we shouldn't say that on TV, but you get crowds to condemn these things. The wiring and the plumbing.
And this has been in the planning for over 2 years and has been needed for much longer than that, truthfully.
Mr. Chairman, you could tell that by the photographs.
Okay, who wants to go next?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Dave Lee. I'm the Director of Public Health and Services for Carleton County. I'll address a few of the aspects of planning for future services, both in Carleton County and then also as a region in relation to last year's state-county redesign. We, in the state of Minnesota, as a state-supervised, county-administered system, we're being held to higher and higher levels of outcomes for our different services, and with shrinking resources, that deals us a few additional challenges. We are looking at how do we coordinate services, both from the ease of the consumer, but also how do we meet those increasing federal outcomes so we're not at risk for losing financial resources to the state of Minnesota. Child support, financial assistance services, working with our veterans, and also working with our workforce center. We need to have our folks co-located both from a citizen standpoint, but also so that we can coordinate services to meet those higher outcomes. A couple of the other things that we're looking at, we're currently working closely with three other counties in northeastern Minnesota under Arrowhead Health Alliance under a Joint Powers Act. And we currently in Carleton County, we're about 50% of the population in that four-county group. As we further expand into the state-county redesign and look at developing a service delivery authority in northeastern Minnesota, that could encompass as many as seven counties. And our new building is being built both with the technology and also with the eye to services of how we can leverage some of our expertise to assist some of those other counties in meeting some of those outcomes. One of the challenges that we have that maybe might not be as obvious as to other parts of the state, we have 22.6% of the land in our seven counties, and we have 6% of the population. So we have a number of challenges geographically to deliver services that seem to be increasing, and also we are dealing with a population that is becoming a bit more elderly. So there are some challenges in that regard, too. So our new building that we are trying to build in infrastructure to be able to, as I say, leverage our expertise and coordinate services not only with our three other AHA counties, but throughout the whole Northeast.
Okay. And Mr. Bodie?
I think I'm here for questions and make these three look better. So.
Okay.
We rely on Mark for that.
How can you make them look better?
Because this is quite a picture from this side over here. Okay, any questions of the committee? Comments? Any Senator Lori, any closing comments?
Well, I just hope you give it your good consideration and view it favorably as you forward your recommendations.
Let me just ask, the bill says $2 million for to acquire land. Is the land ready?
The land is essentially ready. The city has one more parcel to acquire, and they're in the final stages of doing that now.
Okay, and you would use this money for that as well as design, pre-design, road construction, water, sewer, and other infrastructure?
Yes.
That's what it would all be
that's
for?
That's correct.
And so then the rest of the money you'd be getting basically from other sources to build the building?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, any other comments? Any questions, anybody? Okay, Senator, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, appreciate
it. Senate File 1602, Senator Lori.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, we're going to have another set of handouts for the Pine Technical College Business Incubator for our economically distressed region. I'm going to have with me here today Robert Musgrove, the president of Pine Technical College, and I saw Don Howard, the city administrator, and our fair mayor, Jane Robbins, from Pine City as well. This is a project you'll see in the bill introduced last year, Senate File 1602. It was initially a request for $1.2 million with that going to be the match for a large federal grant to support this. The federal EDA has identified this type of project as a really high priority, and over the last year we've worked hard to identify other sources of information, and so I would like to let you know that we're only requesting this year $200,000, and that would be all that we would need to leverage the federal money that they're ready to put on the table. So with that, I'll turn it over to President Musgrove.
Okay, wait. do you want that number changed in the bill then from 1.2
million? Yeah, I mean, but we can't take official action here is my understanding. But, yeah, our request is for $200,000.
We can take official action because we have a quorum now. So
you do, okay.
So you want me to change then on line 1.7 and 1.17, change 1.2 million to 200,000?
Yes.
Okay. Senator Sparks, I'll move that then. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the motion is adopted. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'm a little confused because I didn't think we could vote on things when we're not in session.
We just did.
Yeah, but I'm just asking, would it really count? I understand we voted. I mean, but I don't think we're allowed to. When
at
we're
least
not
we know what the intent of the author is and what the intent of the committee is. So, and then we'll have to make a recommendation to the bonding committee anyway for coming out of here. So,
but
they'll know then that it's a $200,000 request as opposed to $1.2 million.
But at some point when we go into session, then there'll have to be an actual amendment made to the bill.
It all depends. I think the way it's going to work is it's probably going to show up in the bonding bill as opposed to showing up in the actual bill itself as another bill. So I don't know that all these. I mean, we're not going to hear these bills again, and the bonding committee doesn't generally hear these bills. So once we make a letter of recommendation to the bonding committee, then there will be a bill that comes out that's the bonding bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I just wanted to make it clear that we can't actually vote and change the bill today.
Well, that might be true. It might not be.
Okay.
All
right. Okay. I guess in my world, we're not allowed to, Mr. Chair.
I'll definitely take that as good advice, okay?
Thank you. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fishbach, I'm requesting $1.2 million then, but if you guys just forward a $200,000 request, it's okay with me.
Senator Fishbach.
Mr. Chair, I'm not trying to be a problem, and I'm just making sure that he understands that his bill's not been changed if
right.
he needs it to be changed to move forward.
Right.
But if we're just going to have the miraculous bonding bill show up one day, that's fine with the correct numbers.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to make sure that there are rules here that we actually are going to follow. I think a miraculous
bonding bill would be about $2 billion, so we're not going to have a miraculous
bonding bill. The bonding bill just kind of shows up. Yeah. It appears one day.
I know. But it actually gets introduced.
You can put a nice rubber stamp on the top of that.
Yeah, but it does get
They love it.
It does get introduced, just so you know. Okay. Senator Lurie, go ahead.
All right. Well, that is the 40,000-foot level, so I will turn it over to President Musgrove to take us down to maybe 4,000 feet and give you a better feel for what the incubator could do for our region.
Senator Lurie, Mr. Chair, Senators, the opportunity to talk about the project. This is actually a couple of years in the making.
Can you say your name?
Robert Musgrove, President. This bill has actually been... project has been a couple of years in the making. We, in fact, a year ago actually had a grant approved and waiting for us at EDA, able to come up with the match. But since then, we put together more match, and we've negotiated EDA down on the percentage of their the percentage they are requiring of us, so that now we're only seeking $200,000 to fill the final gap, what's essentially a $2.4 million project. Two components to it. The first component would be renovate an existing facility for office space and a classroom. Second component would be 10,000 square foot business incubator, technology business incubator for light industrial manufacturing onto that facility. The whole rest of this, as EDA prefers in these type of projects, is job creation. The intent would be to operate this incubator to attract startup companies into the space. Incubate those companies for 3 years and then move them out on the market after they've got themselves established and create anywhere from 20 to 40 jobs. So it's our estimation that there would be 20 to 40 jobs created every 3 years out of this incubator, moving out on the market to stimulate job creation in high wage areas. It's a partnership project. Our mayor of Pine City, Jane Robbins, is here to speak to that. Our Vice Chancellor for Facilities at MNSCU, Al Johnson, is here to answer any questions regarding that aspect of it. That said, it's a fairly straightforward piece of design. Go in short order. That's the bill's approved and the EDA, which is the grant money. That said, I'd be happy to stand for questions. I know you're sure.
What? Okay, explain to me the reason that this is going through economic development instead of through Minsky. Maybe I missed that. I'm sure you explained it, but I missed it.
One of the main thrusts of this, Mr. Chair, is job creation, which is a better fit for economic development than Minsky, even though it's a Minsky property and Minsky Institution is fostering. It's something of a hybrid project. The precedent for it goes back about 4 or 6 years, and a regional event center funded and built at Southwest State University, where the funds were placed in the economic development portion and then moved on to the Minsky Board of Trustees.
Okay. Do your other witnesses want to say anything?
Yeah. Jane Robbins, the mayor of Pine City, would like to talk about the benefits of this project as well.
Okay. Welcome, Mayor.
Thank you, Senator Lori, Mr. Chair, Senators. Thank you for allowing us to come today, and I just want to comment about this project, it being a community project, a collaborative project that we're really excited about. Everyone is talking today at the local level, at the state level, and at the federal level about job creation. We feel in our community that this is a tremendous project to help address job creation, not only in our city, but throughout our entire community. The funding request of $200,000 will help us make this project become a reality. And we would hope that you would look favorably upon this. $200,000, yes, it's a lot of money, but it's a $2.4 million project that we feel would be a benefit to our community and entire region, and we hope that this will that you will look with favor upon this. We feel that with the programs that are available at Pine Tech in manufacturing and customized training, this opportunity for entrepreneurs across the region, we don't have that existing in our area today, and we really feel that we could benefit the entire region with the creation of jobs. And I thank you very much for allowing us to present.
Thank you, Mayor. Senator Metzen, didn't we hear in committee the other day that small business startups are really booming in Minnesota? Didn't the Commissioner of Economic Development make that kind of a statement in our
committee?
Yeah,
Mr. Chairman, he said that, but as you and the members know, there's a ways to go in Minnesota to compete with some of our neighboring states, whether that be angel investing or other areas, and I think we have to look to those tools to enhance, I think, what you're trying to do, Senator Lori, and so the Jobs Committee is looking at some other parts to this puzzle, and I think your situation kind of complements what we're trying to do, so good work.
Thank you. I would agree, Mr. Chair, Senator Metzen. This is a really critical project. I mean, our region of the state exceeds the state average for unemployment by at least 3 percentage points consistently. We're at about, I think, 11.7 right now. I mean, it's and we've really been struggling to try to figure out how to promote job creation. And these are jobs that would stay in the community then and keep turning through, and we'd find new businesses as we move them through the incubator and keep working. The federal EDA had said that this is really one of the best investments for job creation is this type of incubator model, and that's why they're so bought into this project. Again, I'd just like to highlight that we're asking for $1.2 million, but we'd accept $200,000, which is less than 10% of the $2.4 million project that this would ensure we would be able to get working on right away.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, one more comment.
Senator Metzen.
And we just got to continue to emphasize that this training is statewide significant. It's
yes.
I know it's located Pine County, but this training is for
yep.
all state people. I mean, mm-hmm. anybody that cares to listen and learn up there. So.
And Senator Lori, you have one more witness. Do you want to say anything?
He's just here to make us look good, too.
Oh, okay. Tell us his name, then, so we always make
this is
us
Don Howard, the city administrator for
okay.
Pine City.
Well, welcome. You get points for not saying anything. You get. Okay. Any comments or questions from the committee? Any final comments, Senator Lori?
I hope, again, you look favorably on this request as well.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Senator Lynch. Welcome to the committee, Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm here today with, I guess it's Senate File XXX.
Yes, it is.
Right. And this is a partnership, collaborative project designed in part to support jobs throughout southern Minnesota. This is a project that we've heard about in part before, in that the funding for the pre-design and planning of this project was secured in a previous bonding bill. With that said, this project is situated and ready to go. I will tell you, in terms of other parts of the state, there are 6 workforce centers throughout the state of Minnesota that are located on MinSCU campuses, and what we are seeking to do in the Rochester area is move our workforce center onto our MinSCU campus in a collaborative effort, much like you have seen in some other areas. St. Cloud, I'll highlight as one of those examples. This item, this project is on the MinSCU list. It's number 23 on the MinSCU list. So some of you may have heard about this in the higher ed division. We'll briefly hear from MinSCU today. The focus of our work today, frankly, is on the deed portion of this project. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite Don Cipolla, the president of Rochester Community and Technical College, to join me and make a few comments.
Thank you. Welcome, Mr. Cipolla.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Lynch, members of the committee. We have been discussing a co-located workforce center in Rochester for at least a decade. For the last 10 years, we've talked about making this happen. We did have $280,000 of money appropriated, $200,000 from bonding the last bonding cycle, and $80,000 from deed. We have completed schematic design, so we're ready to move forward with the project. This is a major jobs-producing bill that keeps on giving long after the 50-plus construction jobs have been finished. This is a job service office that we're talking about here. This is, as the senator said, a two-part project. The first part is a $3.2 million request. That's number 23 on the MinSCU capital bonding list. And that piece is to basically install an absorption chiller using steam from the Olmsted County Waste-to-Energy facility, which the legislature funded $5 million of bonding to build a green pipes steam line. Last year, that was matched with $5 million of county money. And that project is under construction right now. So we get heat, lights, utility, those kinds of things from the project for the community and technical college, but it also builds out the infrastructure to accommodate the needs of the workforce center.
Okay, thank you. Who wants to go next?
So I'm Randy Johnson, Executive Director of Workforce Development Incorporated. We're one of the providers in the Workforce Center that provides intensive services. A little history here. Went back 26 years ago, we first established our presence on the RCTC campus, providing services of job training there. It was a great partnership. Lasted for about 8 years. At that time, the college, not only that college, but other colleges we were located at, ran out of room. We all scattered, found other places to do business. In our case, we went to an old building, an old bakery building that we currently occupy, where the Workforce Center is. Built in the 20s, it was never designed for office buildings, but it was part of a renovation project. And about 16 years ago, we brought in the other partners, Job Service, Rehab Services, State Services for the Blind. And about 12 years ago, we actually finally integrated and co-located on Main Space. But it wasn't long before we realized the building had challenges. It was not very efficient to work around massive pillars that were everywhere, a single elevator that had its own unique characteristics. When it rains, we end up with water buckets in the hallway at times and in offices. We've had the basement flooded, and we have environmental concerns with the air quality. That notwithstanding, it's provided service here for us where we've had up to about 10,000 people a year parade through that building. It's wore out. We need to move on. For a community that's third in size in the state of Minnesota, I think we need to work at something different here. So that brings us to where we're at, where we've, as President Cipolla has said, we've completed our design studies now. We think that we could take the facilities that we currently occupy of about 30,000 square feet and efficiently design it, as we have now, to occupy 25,000 square foot building, which actually would provide about 3,000 extra space for other partnerships, including the college itself. So it's a much more efficiently designed building. We're not in a position that if we were to do nothing, that we could actually stay in that building. Our lease ends in about 2 years. And at that time, we're likely to have to find other locations. This is prime timing. If we were to pass the bond now, we could actually occupy at the end of our lease. If not, we're likely to go to another facility and incur another lease that will add some additional expense and start getting into further amortization. So I think this is optimum time to seize the moment here.
Okay, so this is a partnership between Deed and Minsky, in other words.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Deed is the department. There are Deed state employees within there. There's also nonprofit organizations such as us that receive the bulk of our funding through Deed as well. Yes.
Okay. All right. And is everybody on board?
Yes. Yes, this would be great. It's an awesome opportunity.
Okay. Senator Lynch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you pose a very good question. Is everybody on board? We've been working on this initiative for an extended period of time with Minsky and with my local workforce individuals and our local Deed office, and more recently with the commissioner. And I'm pleased to report that as late as yesterday, I got a phone call from the commissioner who indicates that he is supportive of this endeavor, supportive of the project, and will be looking for the recommendations, certainly, that come forth from this committee. But I do think that he'll view this favorably. So I'm pleased to see that endeavor come forward. You know, it's one thing to talk about the need to partner and collaborate. It's an entirely different discussion when the players are asked to really come forward and put their money on the table. And I think we've seen that happen. And in summary, Mr. Chair, I would just say that this project is green. This project is jobs. We have, as a state, previously committed to the planning of this. And I would ask that the committee give this serious consideration. I thought that it was important to lay out clearly for both the higher ed division and for the economic development division that this is, we really need the cooperation of both entities in order that this project can move together.
Mr. Roy, do you want to add anything?
No, I don't need to add anything at this time.
Okay. If I'm not mistaken, let me use your memory again, Senator Metzen, but I think in the joint hearing we had the other day that the commissioner did say he supported the project. So
I believe that's correct.
Okay. So
he had a tie on his recommendation list.
Okay. So it's all the things that we want to see happen in this economy. Jobs, jobs, jobs. Okay. Any comments or questions from the committee? Okay. Any final comments? Okay. And thank you very much. We appreciate it. And we'll lay this over for possible recommendation to the bonding committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
We're going to go a little bit out of order, Senator Anderson. Senator Metzen has an appointment real quickly here, so we're going to take Senator Metzen's bill.
Just
Good afternoon.
Senator Metzen.
Thank you, Chairman Thomasoni and members of the committee. Thanks for taking out of order a little bit at 3 o'clock upstairs. It's pretty important. So this legislation deals with inflow infiltration mitigation for over 35 to 40 cities in the metro area. $14 million in capital bonding for grants. Like I mentioned, it's, we believe it, it's 32 to 40 cities in the metro area receive some of these funds. It would be eligible for the I mitigation grants, but every city would be required to match dollar for dollar bonding money. That inflow filtration mitigation is not solved. We feel this could cost over $1 billion in the next few years to the situation. Of course, what we're dealing with too is impaired waters will be increased if these you will, sewers are combined and and streams in the area. So this is a very timely proposal, and the costs will just multiply if we don't going soon, and also problems again with our Mississippi River with the infiltration of and other things. So with that, I'll let
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities, and we appreciate this opportunity to talk about our request for $14 million in capital appropriation to help Metro Cities with their fixes to their public infrastructure to address excess inflow and infiltration problems. Metro Cities, just so you know, represents 80 cities across the metropolitan region before both the legislature and Met Council on issues of both regional and statewide significance, and this is obviously one of those issues. I want to talk just to briefly explain what inflow and infiltration means. It's not the most glamorous of issues, but it is important. And essentially, just to define it, infiltration occurs when groundwater enters the sewer system through defects in the system. And inflow occurs when stormwater or rainwater enter the system, also through defects in the system. Sources of I&I come through defects in public infrastructure, such as leaking manholes and sewers, and private properties, such as sump pumps, foundation drains, broken laterals, and things like that. Inflow occurs when groundwater seeps into sewer pipes through cracks or leaking joints in deteriorating manholes, and infiltration occurs in direct proportion to significant rainfall. Metropolitan Council has identified, as Senator Metzen said, right, the 2009 list is 37 communities. It's jumped around. Essentially, any city in the metropolitan area can end up on what is called their excess inflow and infiltration list, which means that they have identified those communities as contributing more inflow and infiltration to the system than their system can handle. So the reason that this is regionally significant is because the sewer system was designed to accommodate a certain level of population growth, which right now is estimated to be 1 million people by 2030. So that treatment capacity needs to be used in a way that accommodates that population growth. It was not designed to accommodate having excess inflow and infiltration coming through the system. And this is essentially clear water that does not need to be treated. So it's using up capacity that was designed for growth, not this excess I&I issue. I&I is also a significant health and safety concern. If you have sewage spills, that obviously threatens the health and safety of the population. When a local system gets overloaded, it can cause backup, sewage backup in basements, and the like. The Met Council has identified if we fix this issue locally by having cities do the fixes, and included in your packet is a list of cities that were identified in 2009 by the Met Council. And the council essentially, there's a number there by each city, and essentially what that reflects is the council's assessment of what it would cost that particular city to make the fixes. So cities have gone out. They're working to do the fixes. They can be very expensive, and the more that you do, the more expensive it gets. If cities don't make these fixes, the Met Council will essentially assess them this penalty or this surcharge. If cities do the work, they can get refunded the money. The council has estimated that fixing this program at the local level is expected to cost about $150 million total, and that does include both fixes on the public side and on the private side. If cities don't fix this problem at the local level, they're anticipating that they're going to need to build additional capacity in a few years, at which point the cost jumps up to about $1 billion. They'll start assessing cities for those costs, and those won't be refundable. And really, that's not something anybody wants to do, is to have additional wastewater treatment capacity being built to address issues that could be addressed on the upfront at the local level. So what we're here today to do is ask for this capital appropriation to assist cities on the public side of those infrastructure fixes. And with that, I will turn it over. We have the cities of Golden Valley and West St. Paul here today. Mayor Linda Loomis from Golden Valley, Janine Clancy, their public works director, and Matt Somm, the public works director for the city of West St. Paul. Excuse me, whoever wants to go first.
I'll go first. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. As Ms. Nauman said, I'm from West St. Paul. My name is Matt Somm. We are one of the lucky or unlucky cities, however you want to look at it, that is on the Met Council surcharge list. Just a few figures first, and then I'll get into what we've done at our own local level. Our current West St. Paul five-year surcharge with the Met Council is just under $1 million. It's $972,000. Annually, it's just under $205,000. So that's the amount of money that we need to spend either on our system or else we pay it to the Met Council. For 2010, our annual surcharge represented a 15% increase on top of our annual sewer bill to the Met Council. So what really have we done at the city? Since the surcharge program started back in 06-07, we completed our own I&I study to try to find out where the issues were in town. On our own public system, annually we clean 20 miles of sewer. We televise another 6 miles, and what that does is to help us isolate or find where the issues are at. First we clean it, and then we look at it with a TV camera. Following that, any areas that need to be repaired, we've annually been letting a construction project to line our existing sewer pipe, and that's been in the area of $120,000 to $175,000. But as Ms. Nauman said, the problem isn't just on the public side, it's also on the private side. Service pipes that go to businesses or private homes are also leaking or have sump pump connections to them. So realizing that, back in 2008, just a couple years ago, we did begin a private property inspection program in our own town. The city contributed funds for private service repairs to our residents through a repair grant program where we paid for half of the cost of the sewer repair. To date, we've inspected 700 properties. As far as what we've spent since 07, when this began, we spent a little over $200,000 back in 07. And last year, we spent $630,000. Over the last 3 years, we've spent $1.2 million on I&I-related repairs. Our future city costs, what we're expecting to pay, or the need that's still out there. On the private side, we're estimating a future need of over $1 million in repairs. That's just for the next 3 years. On our public infrastructure, we're at $720,000, a little less. So our total need over the next 3 years is $1.76 or $1.75 million. Yet our 2010 budget only has $170,000 budgeted for it, just a tenth of what we need. With that, I'll turn it over to Janine from Golden Valley.
Mr. Sam, I don't know, maybe this is for Ms. Nauman, I'm not sure, but some of these, have you guys applied for Public Facilities Authority money, PFA money, and do these projects qualify for PFA money? Do you know that? We got a list of them here, and I know there's a couple hundred that are going to get done this year. I don't know if any of these cities are on the list or not, but I...
PFA?
Yeah, money. Public Facilities Authority, yeah.
Mr. Chair, we have not applied for that.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that money is applicable here. We can certainly check that out, but I'm not aware that money would be used to fund fixes like this.
Okay.
This grant the bill is structured as such that the money would go to the Metropolitan Council. It could go to the PFA if the legislature so chose to do that as well.
I think it's wastewater money in the PFA, so I'm assuming that's what this is, but I realize it's I&I, but anyway. Okay. Who wants to go
and
next?
If I could ask Mayor Lund. Restating some of the facts that are very similar between Golden Valley and West St. Paul.
Can you say your name for the record?
Oh, please? I'm sorry. My name is Janine Clancy, and I'm the Director of Public Works for the City of Golden Valley.
Okay.
What I would like to just mention is that the surcharge that is being faced by the City of Golden Valley over a five-year program is $1.95 million. In the City of Golden Valley, one of the things that compounds Golden Valley's issue is that we purchase our water from the City of Minneapolis, which is surface water, so we also are compounding that with some of the highest water rates in the metropolitan area. So our utility rates tend to be very high. Our water, our sanitary sewer system is in the vintage of 50 to 60 years old, so that both the private side as well as the public side is an aging infrastructure. And so while we're addressing it on a capital improvement program, we're also asking our private residents to address their private systems. And that has been a very politically difficult issue for us. I think that most people feel that their private system is something that is out of sight, out of mind. And when we're asking them to address an issue that is anywhere between $3,000 to $7,000 in addition to a high utility rate, they become very concerned. As Mr. Sam indicated, we have a systematic method of going through the city through our capital improvement program, but we are finding that we have many unmet needs. We expect to be wrapping up our capital improvement program with our street improvement program in about 2016. But in fact, our I&I program will exceed many years beyond that because we have many miles of streets where the sanitary sewer issues have not been addressed. And so with that, I would like to ask Mayor Loomis to address some comments in terms of some of the political repercussions that she's experienced because of the difficulties implementing this program.
Ms. Loomis, welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Linda Loomis. I am the mayor of Golden Valley, and this has become a political issue. We adopted an ordinance where we started inspecting the private lines in town as well as our public lines just because we have many more miles of private sewer lines than we have public. And we did that back in 2006, and we've had two election cycles since then, and every year it is a problem for the incumbents who are trying to do the right thing. We're trying to preserve capacity in the regional wastewater treatment system and protect the river so that we don't have sewage overflows during heavy rain events. And unfortunately, geography is one of our problems that we're fighting. We're a victim of it here in Golden Valley because of our clay soils and our high water tables. So we are one of the most egregious contributors to inflow and infiltration, and somehow our residents, they're paying for it through the municipal side, through their utility bills, but then with our inspection program, they also have to pay for it privately for their private lines. So we've been very serious about trying to address this and would appreciate some help since this is a regional issue.
Well, Senator Metzen, this is similar to that Duluth bill we heard last week where they've got the same kind of issues.
Yes, that's correct. And I might add, it's not just the 40 or so cities in the metro area. It will affect the flow southwestern Minnesota along the river cities south. So this water continues to be impaired. And so it stretches beyond the 40 so cities to the southwestern corridor, Red Wing, Hastings, on and on and down that way. So,
Senator Parcell.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know whose handout this particular one is, but the list on the second page, what is the significance of the single digits in the parentheses by some of those cities?
Mr. Chair and members, looking at the little single-digit numbers, cities that have those numbers, the number one reflects communities that have qualified, requested, and were granted a 25% cap relative to their municipal wastewater charge on the surcharge, meaning that they've been able to defray some of the cost because it's cost-prohibitive, so they've worked with the Met Council to sort of stretch out the cost. The number two reflects communities that have completed their total five-year inflow and infiltration mitigation plan. So they've solved the problem for now. And number three reflects communities that have been removed from the list through a formal appeals process. And I believe Lakeville is the only city on the list that has a number three.
Thank you. So this is a little bit off the subject, but so Ms. Nauman, your number one fan is here. And I was just wondering, not very often that we have husband and wife teams in here, and I was just wondering, do you like at night go home and he critiques you or you critique him, or how
pretty much.
Is that how it works? No, you don't get the comment.
We're the number one fans
okay,
today.
Okay.
Get this passed.
Right, okay. Okay. Any questions or comments from the committee on this particular project? Senator Metzen, any questions?
No, just this is quite well. It's very environmentally necessary to get this done, and the cost will just quadruple if we attack this right away, and the rivers and streams will get more polluted.
Okay. Anybody else want to make any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair,
okay,
members.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion for recommendation to the bonding committee. Senator Anderson, thank you for being patient.
We're going to start with the ballpark one or
okay.
The Port Authority one.
Which one do you want? It's up to you. We have 3M site redevelopment and St. Paul Regional Baseball Facility.
I think we'll start with the ballpark one, please.
Okay.
Senate file 2161.
Senator Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Come on up.
Senator Anderson, anytime you're ready.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee members. It's a pleasure to be here with a request for $25 million to design and construct a ballpark in downtown St. Paul to be the state and regional headquarters, essentially, for our amateur and youth and minor league baseball activities in the state of Minnesota, including the St. Paul Saints, which is probably the best-known minor league baseball team in America. I think we can say that. I don't say that. I'm sure Mike will. Should. And I think most of the members of this committee or some of them that serve on the bonding committee have been to see the Midway Stadium, the old stadium that's been in place for 30-some years that is literally crumbling and falling down and needs to be replaced. And that stadium something that can't be, well, it needs to be, we need a new facility, and it makes sense to build the new facility, a new ballpark, a state-of-the-art, green, community-friendly ballpark in downtown St. Paul. And I say that as the senator who represents the district where the existing facility is and where it's crumbling, and probably the only person in Minnesota who had my wedding reception at that facility. It means a lot to me. But its time has come and gone, and it's time to build a new facility. And we have this incredible opportunity to use this new facility as something that will be a statewide resource for all of your communities, for all those kids who play baseball, whether they're in an high school, little league, or college. St. Paul has been the center of those baseball activities for many, many, many years, since the first regional ballpark was built in St. Paul in 1903. We've been the regional ballpark center for, and we love hosting those events. And so this new ballpark would be downtown in the lower town area. The plan is to make it the greenest ballpark in the country and to serve the community. And I say that because it's important. This is not just a ballpark facility for the St. Paul Saints, although they are the marquee, kind of the best-known part of the facility, but this is about serving the community. And the existing facility is programmed with activities over 200 days a year, mostly amateur sports and amateur baseball competitions and games, and only 50 of those days are Saints games. So this is not just about the Saints. This is about supporting amateur baseball around the state. And we're going to hear from the American Legion about how much that means to their organization and how involved they are in that. So I'm going to let the others who really know this the best talk about it, but I'm excited about this opportunity, and I just want you to picture where it is. Downtown St. Paul, down by the farmers market, right where the light rail will end up by Union Depot, so you could take a train there, and where three different bicycle trails converge, state biking paved trails converge. So there's lots of opportunities for access and for bringing lots of people to St. Paul, including your constituents, who we will welcome for all of these games that we are glad to host. I want to introduce Mike Hom, who is the St. Paul Parks and Recreation Director, who will be speaking, Gail Calada from the American Legion, and Mike Beck, who's one of those St. Paul Saints owners. And Mike, I just have to say, by way of introduction, many of you may know of his father, Bill Beck, who owned the Chicago White Sox and kind of made a lot of history as an innovative owner. And Mike has taken that tradition and run with it and made the Saints the most fun place to go watch baseball that I've been to lately. And you all have wonderful teams in your communities, and we love to play them. And someone handed me this, and this is just an example of, you know, kind of Saints, what the Saints do. They like to have fun. They like to make baseball fun. They like to make community events fun for everybody and welcoming. And so there's this whole tradition and institution. I don't know if you can see the two faces on this bobblehead. One would be Franken, one would be Norm Coleman. So you can put it in whichever face you prefer. And with that, let me turn it over to,
Senator Anderson, before we go any further, I got to find out, it had to be your husband's idea to have the wedding reception at the ballpark.
How did you know? It took me about 6 months to agree.
Yeah,
he finally wore me down. And you know what? It was one of the best decisions we've ever made. It's kind of, you know, the story of married life, right? You know, you get these... Whatever. No, I won't go there.
Yeah.
You have to take turns with those. You have to take turns with
Senator
those. But
Perso.
I wish I'd brought a photo of that, because it was a gorgeous day and it was so much fun.
It was an outdoor reception?
Bowling alley. Right?
Well, Mr. Chair, I was kind of thinking flowers.
Stand right there so I can hit you.
But we had, this was the best, it was really, really fun. And Willie Murphy's band played. Around first base, I think, and then there was frisbee and softball, and we had a smorgasbord and of food, and it was a wonderful day, and it was a really great way to start off our married life. And we still love baseball. Now we have two little guys growing up who are good pitchers, and we have hopes for them into the future.
So you're the perfect author for this bill, then.
There you go.
All right. Okay. Who wants to go first?
Mike Hom will go first. Mr. from Hom, Parks and Rec.
Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, I am Mike Hom, the Director of Parks and Recreation for the City of St. Paul. And as the Director of Parks and Recreation, I can attest that Senator Anderson's sons are indeed good pitchers. So, It's my pleasure to share some details related to the project that I'm very passionate about. I want to quickly acknowledge a handful of supporters we have in the room that are affiliated with the project team, and also a handful of supporters that are community members supporting regional amateur athletics and regional amateur baseball. So I'm grateful that they are here. The bonding request is for $25 million, and that request will leverage $10 million of local project costs to finance the construction of the ballpark. We'll also leverage $10 million of related costs necessary to acquire the site and deliver the site and infrastructure related to the site. So it's a $45 million project. A bit about the numbers. As it is constructed, it will directly result in 225 construction jobs on the site, and it will generate $2.7 million in construction-related taxes. When it opens and we operate it, it will support 240 ballpark jobs and directly generate annual taxes due to the state of Minnesota in the range of $575,000. In addition to that direct economic impact, the sheer multiplier effect of bringing 400,000 visitors to downtown St. Paul in our community is substantial. It's hard to quantify, but it will deliver a lot of economic vitality to our city. As Senator Anderson mentioned, St. Paul has hosted regional ballparks since 1903. The current Midway Stadium is simply falling apart. Those of you that have been fortunate or unfortunate to see it on bonding tours recognize that. For years, we have worked to squeeze high volumes of activity through the existing site and use what we have. We have been as creative as we can be in doing things like to make it work, like luxury or auxiliary bleacher systems, far from luxury, remote concession operations, and if it's possible to testify to the state Senate that porta potties are creative, we've maximized what we can do with those things. We've pushed this thing to its limits, and there's a series of things in play where it's time to move forward from where we sit right now. One quick example that you can all probably relate to is the lighting system. The lighting system is part of the original construction in 1981. It's really inadequate to cover the field in the spaces for what we use it for and what the ballpark needs are. It's also very inefficient in terms of energy consumption and things important to all communities like the energy bleed of the lighting as it reflects out into the greater community. So there's probably 2 to 3 dozen individual examples like that of things that are broken in disrepair with the stadium. The Midway Stadium is presently open for a 210-day season. About one-third of those dates are related to the St. Paul Saints ball club. The other two-thirds or 100 uses are community uses such as the state high school baseball tournament and various levels and all types, really, of amateur athletics and amateur sports. Why this project is very exciting is given the current circumstance that Midway needs to be replaced and the fact that there's an obvious regional demand for having a ballpark such as this, we have a great opportunity in downtown St. Paul to site this facility, and it is Senator Anderson referenced the Lower Town area. If you picture the XL Energy Center on one end of downtown St. Paul, this site would be directly opposite that on the far end of downtown St. Paul from the XL Energy Center. The graphics you have in your handout, and the graphic that's being placed up on the easel right now depict the site, and it's at the nexus of all these regionally significant transportation opportunities. It is at the terminus of the Central Corridor Light Rail Transit Line. It is at the location of the operation and maintenance facility for that transit line. It's right next door to the Highway 52 or Lafayette Bridge project, which is poised and ready to go in the queue for MnDOT. It's at where the Bruce Bento Regional Trail meets up with Regional Trail, the Sam Morgan Regional Trail on the river. It's also at the terminus of the Gateway State Trail. It's at literally a block away from the Union Depot and where the future home to high-speed rail is going to be. So in terms of access to clear access to transportation and parking, it has clear access to those facilities in a manner that's not just relevant to what we're doing today, but what we're planning for in the future. I think you'll also recognize that all of those projects are things that the state has invested in order to leverage federal funds and other local funds. From my perspective, if we were going to site this facility any place in our system, any place in the region, we have opportunity to access that site right now. So that's why it's so tremendous. It's also a great fit for this downtown neighborhood. It's an area that's growing. We have growing residential, we have growing businesses, and we have restaurants and nightlife that support those businesses. We know from our experience with projects like this in St. Paul and around the region that private development will follow our ability to move forward with this ballpark. We have a great private sector partner in the St. Paul Saints. We've worked with them locally since 1993. They've earned their reputation nationally and internationally as a best-in-class organization. I'd like to reference, they were in 60 Minutes, and it was in a good way. And I think you'll have an opportunity to hear from Mr. Beck shortly. But we also have hundreds of individual groups that are our partners on a daily basis as we program our existing Midway Stadium. And representing them, if it pleases the chair, I'm very pleased to transition the presentation to Gail Collada.
Before we go to Ms. Collada, let me just ask, you gave a bunch of really impressive tax numbers, which I think are very important and reasons for doing this. Are they up and above what it's generating right now, or in addition to how much more are we getting here? Is there more? Is it relatively the same as what's happening now, or do you know that? Or maybe this is for Senator Anderson or for you, Mr. Nam. Why not rebuild it where it is as opposed to locating it downtown?
Mr. Chair, committee members, the short answer, of course, the construction numbers are all numbers that would be new numbers. The tax numbers that will be generated once it's opened will expand what we can deliver at the existing Midway facility. We can do some research and try to break that down and report back. But that's precisely why this the data you will see when we report back is precisely why we're so excited about this project, because the economic activity that this can generate in a location like downtown St. Paul compared to what we're able to do at the existing Midway Stadium site is the potential to expand upon our program is great.
Okay. Senator Kielash.
My question isn't so much about the ballpark but the location. The state's investing millions of dollars to get that light rail line to end there, and I'm not sure that the economic development potential of that area is really being met by the ballpark. And so that would be my question, because wouldn't the light rail station bring a whole lot of other housing and other economic activity that would exceed what the ballpark could generate for the state?
You know, Mr. Chair and Senator, that's a great question, but I think that all those things will happen as well. But this particular site is too polluted to really use for a lot of other things. You can't put housing on it. It would take too much. I mean, it's impossible. So it's a perfect site to use for something like this. But there's other, you know, surrounding areas right in that neighborhood that will be enhancing housing, retail, et cetera. And we also know, I mean, Mike talks about, and he'll get a chance to talk about this, how many visitors the Saints already get in the current little crumbling facility that's kind of landlocked by train tracks and a car wash and a couple other things, you know. And putting it in this downtown area means you're going to generate so much more economic activity around it that will really complement that redevelopment potential. So I think this will be kind of one of the cornerstones, like the Union Depot, that will bring in development around it. Whereas right now there's not really any – you have a cult following of this team over in this little place in my district by the train tracks, a former, you know, little industrial site, and it's just kind of not – it's just not living up to its full potential, as incredible as it is already, the amount of visitors they have coming to it, it could magnify it. So, well, I mean, Mike can really speak to that, too.
It definitely needs new showers. I know that. See, who came up with the RBI? I really like the RBI. That's really good. That you?
Grace, yeah.
Who wants to go next? Ms. Collado?
Ms. Collado is next. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing my testimony. My name is Gail Collado, and I am the co-4th District Director of American Legion Baseball here in Minnesota. And I have handed out a written copy of my testimony. Just to be brief, I've cut back my verbal comments, so you can refer to that handout for additional information and background related to the potential of this facility for American Legion Baseball in the future. American Legion Baseball supports this bill wholeheartedly. We do use the current Midway facility on a regular basis for both league baseball games for high school-aged players in the summer months. We also use the facility extensively for our playoff tournament each year. And to reinforce our support, although he could not be here today, the state director of American Legion Baseball, he does support this as well on behalf of all 350 American Legion teams across the state as a regional ballpark that can be used for, yes, many purposes for amateur baseball down the road. The construction of a new baseball facility as proposed under this bill basically would provide youth baseball teams all across the region, including American Legion teams, the opportunity to play in the type of a facility that really is needed. And it also provides potential in the future for American Legion and other programs to host major tournaments, bringing many visitors and providing opportunities for baseball players and enthusiasts like me to gather and enjoy our great American pastime. My involvement with American Legion Baseball, just on an FYI basis, is purely volunteer. I do what I do simply for the enjoyment of really being able to watch these young people who want to grow through playing the game of baseball. Last year, the American Legion World Series was held in Fargo at a beautiful facility that many of you might know called Newman Outdoor Field. Being at the American Legion World Series, one of the greatest enjoyments for me during that particular tournament was just looking at those young ball players in awe of that great facility that they were playing in. Comments that they made about the fact that it made them feel like major league ball players. And the type of facility that's being proposed for me really means that in the future it would be great to be able to hear some of those same comments from young ball players like I heard last year, but on Minnesota soil in the future at a great new ballpark facility. So any questions that you might have, I'd be happy to answer them. And, again, thank you for allowing my testimony on behalf of the American Legion.
Well, that's one of my claims to fame as I played in the 1970 American Legion State Tournament.
Where was it?
It was in Winona.
And, Mr. Chairman, I know since you're from the northern area of the state, you'd also be happy to know that Minnesota, we're one of the strongest states in nationwide with American Legion baseball participation. But despite that, we're actually second or third in the nation every year in terms of the number of registered teams in the state. But despite that, Minnesota has only hosted the American Legion World Series three times. Once it was in Minneapolis in the early 1940s. In the 1950s, it was in St. Paul. But in 1980, the city of Ely hosted the American Legion World Series.
They have a very nice ball field up there, too. Mm-hmm. And we always had a heck of a time beating them. They were very, very good in Ely. I don't know why, but they were.
They're still good.
Yeah, they are. Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions of Ms. Collado? So one last question. What kind of name is that, Collado? Is that Finnish?
Mr. Chairman, actually, the name is Czech, but Czech, okay. I'm pretty much 100% Polish.
Okay.
Not too much.
My mother's maiden name was McNowski.
Any other ethnic questions before I go on to Ms. Noel? Okay, Mr. Vec, go ahead.
Senator and Mr. Chair, I just want to say that that 1970 Winona team was my all-time favorite. Somewhere I have your...
No, that's where the tournament was.
I spoke to my mother this morning. She's 89, and she asked what I was doing, and I said I was going to come and testify, and she said apologize for all the stupid promotions that the Saints have done to Minnesotans all these years, so... I apologize. I'm Catholic, so I have to do exactly what she says.
Trapped again.
No confessions here, okay?
We know that the amateur program feeder system for our program, that being the Saints, because Dan Kazrowski, who played for Hamlin and showcased his talents there, at Midway, was then signed by the Saints and became the 26th round draft pick for the Diamondbacks. So there is a chain of baseball. But more importantly, it's a feeder system for our fans, for kids who come to be entertained and to learn what I think is the most cerebral, most wonderful game ever invented. And those 156 events that Michael spoke of, which 50 were Saints games, we are, in every sense of the word, the minor league supplier of fans for Major League, not only baseball, but for sports in general. And a new facility for Minnesotans would mean increased potential for television projects, which would beget more and more projects, NCAA tournaments, American Legion tournaments. It's a crime that went to Fargo, you know, and isn't in St. Paul in a hotbed of baseball. It's an opportunity, though, as Billy Peterson put it the other day, which was one of the most eloquent things, is that a team of senior men, 25 of them, can go and play in a ballpark in which they're proud to be there, in which memories are made, and we need that kind of a facility. That's why we're willing to step up. The high school tournament, when I first got here, I was told there's only one rule about Midway, and that is that you work around the high school tournament every year. And going into our 18th year, our schedule is comprised of dates around the high school tournament, because we've never turned down a request for a charity or for participation in some event, because we understand this ball club has done 102% occupancy since its inception. And it's not because we're wizards, as you've probably already seen. It's because of the community in which we reside. And the vision for this ballpark, this is the one thing I'm inordinately proud of. The only ballpark, whatever the prices are when we leave Midway, those will be the prices when we walk into a new facility. $5 tickets to $12 tickets, $2 hot dogs, $3 beers. It's affordability. People are always saying, well, it's outdoor baseball and that's your niche. But that's about to be challenged, and it's really not. Well, the other thing is L.A. has not called us, so we're not threatened. You know. This is our home. Minnesota's our home. There'll be 7,500 seats. It's like a farmer's market Saturday. Annie Heidekoper, our Vice President of Community Relations, says, we're the front porch of Minnesota, and I'm really proud of that. It's a gathering place. People like to say it's not about the baseball. No, it's not. It's about the community, and it's about a gathering place, and it's about our kids and the sound of laughter, and where heroes are still fashionable. Year-round use, we'll be able to flood the field and have a rink there. We can use it in November. This can truly be a community gathering place that'll be used for 11 months. 210 dates now with the current facility are possible dates, of which we filled 156. But a new facility, I think it burgeons. It'll be the first ballpark built around an art display, a permanent art display. Any of you who've been to Midway know that we rely on only two things, art and plants, to keep the building up. And a lot of layers of paint on it. But the concourse in the new ball yard will be a permanent art display. There will be modulars on each of the four corners. In honor of Hibbing's most famous citizen, I would like to see 4th Street renamed positively 4th Street. There'll be a classroom inside for sports marketing. We hope to partner with the college, and we think we'll do 400,000 people in 4 months, and the Y will do 800,000 in 8 months, and we think it will help. But mostly, we want to thank you for that 102% occupancy. So we'll keep the prices low. Well, thank you.
Mr. Vecchi, give me a pretty good segue to the obvious question that we have to ask you, and even though you gave a real lot of reasons and to my answer, and let me preface this by saying I support the project. People will want to know why the Saints and not the Vikings, and maybe that, I don't know if that matters to you, but maybe you should just address that for.
Well, I'd love to answer that directly. It's 100 and what I envision to be 150 other events. I don't know what the Vikings' plans are, although they had a wonderful season. But the fact is that we came up with our contribution based on our usage of the ball yard. But we're a tenant, and we're second to the amateur program, frankly. And that's the difference. If you come to Midway Stadium today and want to go on the field, we don't have barriers. You can go right out there because this is it's a field that belongs to the people. And so we think our contribution is commensurate with our usage of the facility.
Okay. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Metzen just walked in. I know you were a great ball player too, weren't you?
Oh, I'm a legend in my own mind.
That's what I figured. Yeah.
That was my favorite team also.
It's too bad it's the St. Paul Saints. We've got 90 acres cleared land out in South St. Paul right at the border. Overlooking the river.
Ooh. Oh, Anderson, I'm sorry. You mean I can finally threaten someone?
I'm trying to give you a little leverage.
There you go.
It's all cleared, sewer and water, right beyond the Lafayette Bridge.
Chair, I also want to point out that this team, they really do support the Vikings, and last week they sent out a press release. Their new logo for the week in honor of the Vikings. It didn't really work, unfortunately, but they took the S word out of their team and they named it the Paul last week. Temporary logo just to show their support for
I see. Okay.
Football.
I know you're thinking cheap theatrics, but it made the New York Times.
I don't know anything.
Well, your mother, did your mother know about it?
No,
no sir.
No, okay.
No, sir.
We were, Mr. Chairman, we were out, was it last year, Senator Anderson, we toured the place, and I tell you what, why would you want to put your uniform in those rooms you got there?
Well, wasn't there a former twin that walked in there one
terrible
day and practiced for one day and then left and never even showered or anything or something like that because it was so bad?
People don't realize, but we have sent 100 players back to major league organizations. We've sent 28 back to major league teams, Daryl Strawberry and Kevin Millar. But the gentleman to whom you're referring, Scott Layas, mm-hmm. We believe that we could rehab his career and send him back to a major league team within a month. And Scott came and worked out for 2 hours and took one look at our facility and drove home in his uniform with his cleats on, which I think is illegal. Wouldn't even shower in there.
Yeah, it's not
and, and I don't blame him, to tell you the truth, because I saw those showers in those locker rooms, and I don't know how you guys do it. So, but anyway, okay. Any other questions or comments? Senator Anderson, any final comments?
No, we just appreciate your support for this, and it's obviously more than not just a local issue. This is something that the whole state will benefit from, and we look forward to everyone participating in this great facility. Well, thanks for
okay.
listening.
Thank you all very much, and we'll lay this over for a recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you.
Great job.
And Senator Anderson, you have 3M Site Development Senate File 1303.
Danny.
Sparks.
But he did great. Cool.
stay for the 3M site redevelopment because it's really exciting too. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your attention. The other bill that I have to present today and ask for support for is Senate File 1303. And this is a request for $5.2 million for new infrastructure for cleaning up and redeveloping the site formerly occupied by a major 3M facility. And what's really significant about this, I answer you here, you've heard a lot of redevelopment proposals. And I just want to emphasize a couple things about this, and then Lori Lauder from the St. Paul Port Authority can fill you in more detail. But this is a very large redevelopment project. It's a lot of acres, and there's a lot of opportunity for jobs. And I know that your committee especially is focused on job creation. And what really stands out about this is the opportunity to create over 1,500 jobs with this new redevelopment. And I know Ms. Lauder can talk about this economic impact study that was done on this, but it's construction jobs and permanent jobs, many of which could be manufacturing or other really high-quality, high-wage jobs that will be employment opportunities not just for St. Paul, but for that number of jobs you're talking about, a regional impact. And the facility itself would be right off the Fallon Boulevard, which connects directly in 35E and the interstate system. So again, it creates an opportunity for business development that will serve the whole metropolitan area. So it's really significant for our economic growth in the state of Minnesota. So with that, I'd like to ask Ms. Lauder to speak to some of the.
Ms. Lauder, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Senator Anderson. Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson just mentioned something about impact to the state of Minnesota, and I will get into more details in a few minutes here, but did want to emphasize this is a very large project, as the Senator said, and this will provide a significant positive economic impact over time to the state of Minnesota from the beginning and through time. Mr. Chair, just to orient everyone to the site, this site is located just up the hill from Metro State University on 7th Street, about a mile from there. It's located about a mile from 35E. It is just north of 7th Street and just on the south side of the Fallon Boulevard. And you do have maps in your packet, of course. Wanted to mention that this is about a $30 million redevelopment project. This is the largest project that the St. Paul Port Authority will have done since the Energy Park redevelopment project in the Midway part of St. Paul way back in the early 1980s. And we have cobbled together out of that $30 million need, we've cobbled together to this point, Mr. Chair, about $20 million. That includes a Port Authority bond sale of $16 million. We do have site control. We purchased the site from 3M, which abandoned the site, unfortunately. And this site, when it was at its highest point, being owned and operated by 3M, had about 1,000 or two jobs. And our goal is to bring economics back to this site and to the state of Minnesota. The leverage, we think, in terms of asking you and your colleagues for $5.2 million for infrastructure improvement in the construction of a new road on a part of this site, the leverage is large. Mr. Chair, at this point, since we have put in so far $20 million, that's about a 4-to-1 leverage by our math. And we would want to point out that we very much appreciate your consideration of this $5.2 million request. The outcomes, as Senator Anderson mentioned, are huge. And let me go through just a couple of points for you. Once we finish redeveloping this 46-acre site, now called Beacon Bluff, we expect that the private sector will come in and provide about $50 million on a conservative estimate of private sector investment. That will, of course, turn into tax revenues, we believe, of at least $1.5 million, probably closer to $2 million per year to the taxing jurisdictions. wanted to mention, and you have this in your packet as well, as far as what we plan to do with the $5.2 million, which is essential, I should add, in terms of allowing us to market this site to growing businesses and to make this site accessible to the ongoing business operations and their suppliers, as well as make this site integrated into the neighborhood. First of all, as one of your maps shows, we're going to take this large 12-acre site here, and we need to carve that up a bit. So we propose to develop a new road coming off of the existing street system that will go over to here to Russell and then down. So it's a new L-shaped street, newly constructed utilities, street, curb and gutter and so forth, that will have a curb cut onto the Phelan Quarter. Very marketable site. In fact, we do have some business, as we call them, tire kickers at this point, but of course we can't accommodate them quite yet. The other part, if you can see here, inside portion, we have Bush Street, Mendota, and Lorraine. These three streets need reconstruction and the utilities underneath. Mr. Chair, we have a bit over 100 years' worth of infrastructure. We need to make sure that those are upgraded as well as the street system. So the internal reconstruction and the new road constitute the $5.2 million request. In closing, Mr. Chair, I'd like to mention the statewide impact, and I think you see this on your handouts. We retain the services of the State Department of Economic Development, and they have provided these numbers based on a model called REMI, the Regional Economic Model Incorporated, which is about a 20-year-old system. Some parts of the state have already used this as well. It's been used across the country as well. The PCA uses it. The DNR has used it, being a customer of DEED. So in short, I'd like to mention, as Senator Anderson did, that the construction jobs on this almost 50-acre site would equal a little over 1,500 in number. And while those construction jobs are in place, constructing the new facilities by our private sector customers, the spinoff effect will be, on a one-time basis, almost $93 million to the state of Minnesota. And then we look at permanent jobs. Our estimates, based on all of our experience and expertise, is that about 1,000 jobs on a conservative basis, permanent jobs, would be located here. And then the spin-off effects would be about another 460 jobs throughout the state. And that gets to supplier network activity as well. And lastly, Mr. Chair, on an ongoing basis, every year after full operations of this Beacon Bluff Business Center, after we redevelop it and our customers build all their facilities, every year will be approximately $132 million into the state, which will increase the state's gross product by that amount. So we are very pleased to present this to you, and we do wish and ask you for a positive review of this. This is a jobs effort. This is a tax-based effort. This is a state of Minnesota effort. And this is something that not only the east side of St. Paul can be proud of, because it's completely vacant now, with one exception, which I will explain. And we believe that this is exactly what you would be looking for the state of Minnesota. The exception is this. If you look at that blue parcel over there, and you have this on your handout as well, it is the westerlymost parcel of the 3M holdings that the Port Authority now has fee ownership of. And that is under construction. And I would ask you, if you're driving around the neighborhood, please go look. The walls have just gone up. And so what's coming out of that four and a half acre blue site? We actually sold this site a few months ago to HealthEast. They are constructing a new ambulance center and emergency medical technician training center, about a $5 million project. And we are happy and very pleased to be part of the financing, as well as selling HealthEast this land. We provided, since we had a small but distasteful amount of federal New Market tax credit allocation, we were able to make this project happen by putting some New Market tax credits into the financing package. So I did want to be clear that we can all check off the blue site and say sold and under construction, and we certainly know that we did not need the infrastructure for that since it is along Arcade Street. Very much appreciate your time, Mr. Chair. I'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Lauder. Any questions of the committee? Senator Tomasoni.
Senator Anderson, I was on a tour when the bonding committee drove through there, and it's an incredible it's way too nice a site to not have all kinds of jobs and businesses on it. I mean, that's the kind of area it is, and it's unfortunate that 3M had to abandon it. But something needs to be done, and I'm happy to hear there's a little construction going on right now. So it's a very ambitious project, and it's exactly the kind of thing that we need to do to turn around this economy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And, you know, in St. Paul, like a lot of communities, we've lost over 80% of our manufacturing jobs in our city over the last couple of decades, like a lot of places around our state and country. And that part of St. Paul in particular used to have the anchors of the 3M facilities and the Whirlpool manufacturing plant. 3M's still there, but those facilities and most of those jobs are gone. And that's what created neighborhoods. That's what created good-paying, blue-collar jobs that really were the anchor of St. Paul. And so we really want to see that back again. We need that. We need the next generation of jobs there.
Thank you, Senator Anderson. And Council had suggested, did the number going to change a little bit? We had a conversation earlier that maybe we can't, but just if we include this for possible recommendation, would that number change from the $8 million to the $5.2
million? Yes.
Okay.
Yes, and that's to reflect the work that's already been done, or maybe
Ms. Lauder?
Mr. Chair and
yes.
Committee members and Senator
Sorry,
Anderson.
I forgot to emphasize that.
That's fine. Yes, last year we had some very general estimates of costs, and we've been able to refine those through coming into title on some additional land, the middle section that we just closed on about a month and a half ago. And so we have refined numbers for you. So we are actually pleased to say it's going to cost a little bit less than we estimated a year ago.
Yes, so we would ask if the committee would be so kind as to recommend this, that 5.2 would be the amount that we really would need. So okay. Thank you for
thank
pointing
you
that
much.
Out.
Thank you very much, Senator Anderson. Any further questions? If not, thank you, Ms. Lauder. We'll lay this on the table for possible inclusion in the letter of recommendation to the Capital Investment Committee. Thank you
thank very
much.
Much. Appreciate your time. And
come on back, David.
Senator,
thank you.
Appreciate it.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you so much for the opportunity to bring this project before you. This is another St. Paul Port Authority project. This project is urgent, and it is really an emergency project. We have about 1,000 lineal feet of a dock wall in a shipping terminal in an area along the Mississippi River in St. Paul, where the docking wall has failed, and it has created a sinkhole on land where it's been extremely dangerous to operate, and so we've been forced to shut down that area. Which actually has been a critical part of the barge transportation of agricultural products. And so we're here to ask you to help us with $2.4 million in appropriation, bonding appropriations, to help fix this dock wall so that we can address the sinkhole issue and get this port area up and running again. And Ms. Lauder is here to answer more questions. We have some pictures, I believe, to show you, but it's not a complicated
scary
project.
Pictures. Is it all walled off right now so people can't get near it? Walled off was the wrong word, I suppose. But
Mr. Chair, you're very close. It is cordoned off because of the life safety issues and the issues mentioned by Senator Moore.
And how would this be fixed exactly?
I'm sorry?
How would this be fixed? How would it be?
Mr. Chair, we would reconstruct this portion of the dock wall. You have in your packet a map called Barge Terminal Number 1, and you can see that the affected area is a portion of
that upper part, if you will, of Barge Terminal Number 1, which is located, I might add, off of Warner Road and Childs Road as one proceeds southward from downtown. And what we would do is reconstruct this portion of the dock wall. The big picture here, Mr. Chair, is that most of these dock walls in our harbor have been developed during the WPA days, the 1930s Works Progress Administration days. We try to keep up with it, but this emergency situation has really been an over-the-top kind of situation. As you can see, there's a huge sinkhole here. And what we need to do is replace certain portions called whalers and the sheet pile and so forth, because what's happening is the tiebacks, as they're called, have been rotting, and the whalers, which are another piece that one can't see, but an integral part of behind the sheet pile, those have come out of place and are rotting as well. And so we need to replace all of those hooking up components, so to speak, as well as the sheet pile itself. I might add that we've had a truck that whose front part kind of fell into the sinkhole, and unfortunately a human being went past the cordoned off area and fell in as well, and his arms reached out, so he was able to save himself before he fell very deeply and into a very difficult situation. So it is an emergency situation, Mr. Chair. And the farmers, as you probably know, bring their product from their farms to this harbor. And they are able to access worldwide markets by the barge traffic that takes their product and moves it to the Gulf. And in fact, just a little fact here on the environmental situation. I see Mr. Dick Lambert of MnDOT in the audience. I have to credit MnDOT with these statistics. 1 gallon of fuel, Mr. Chair, can move a ton of product 575 miles by barge. That same gallon of fuel provides 435 miles by rail and 155 miles by truck. I say that because the farmers have a reasonably priced method to bring their product through our harbor to the worldwide markets. And, of course, what we're also trying to do is stem the erosion which is going into the river because, of course, everything is seeping through and into the river, which is why we have the sinkhole. So, Mr. Chair, this is an emergency situation. We'd appreciate your and your committee's consideration of this.
And I've noticed, Ms. Lauder, that the bill says pre-design, design, and reconstruct. Are we past the pre-design and design stage? Are we ready to put some cement in the ground? Or?
Mr. Chairman, no, we need to do the pre-design and the design. We are geared up to do that so that, for example, if we were to receive bonding bill funds through this session, we would be able to be under construction and complete the project before next year's frost.
Or the fall of 2010?
Correct.
Okay. All right. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Mwani? Comments.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you so much. I know you've had a long day, and you've had many, many wonderful projects before you, and I thank you for making the time to hear this project.
Well, this looks pretty important to me. It looks like an emergency project that needs to be done. And I know about WPA projects because I've got a bunch of them in my own town, they were pretty well made back then, and they lasted a long period of time, but they definitely need some upgrading now and some maintenance. So I understand. Okay, we'll lay this over then for possible inclusion in the letter to the capital.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
What's the name of it? Investment Committee. Thank you. Who's next? Senator Murphy. Is he here?
Is he here?
If he's not here, we got Senator Wieger or Senator Murphy here. Senator.
It's close.
Is he inside the room?
But I'm here.
Huh?
He's outside the room.
Senator Wieger, sit down at the table. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, division members. We seek $5 million for the Rice Street Bridge. A couple years ago, you appropriated, and we thank you, $2 million for the design engineering, and this project now is ready to go in June. A few more details, and then it's ready. In addition to the obvious safety factors, it's a 73-year-old bridge, and that's very, very important. But this also provides the needed infrastructure for jobs. And we're delighted with the opportunity, a real success story, by hearing what St. Jude Medical has to say about the impact for their bioscience company. And so I have two testifiers. You'll hear from St. Jude and then from Ramsey County, which has also provided investment into this project to further elaborate on details for the project. First, Mr. Chair, I'd like to call on Angie Craig, Vice President, Corporate Relations at St. Jude Medical.
Thank you very much.
Craig, welcome to the committee. Say your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Angie Craig, Vice President, Corporate Relations, St. Jude Medical. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify here today. We have included in your packet a letter of testimony, so I won't belabor your day by going through that letter line by line. But on behalf of St. Jude Medical, we do appreciate the opportunity to comment on the proposed legislation, which is sponsored by Senator Wieger, relating to the appropriation of grants to support Ramsey County bioscience business development. In brief, we believe that as a company with 14,000 employees globally, 2,250 here in the Twin Cities, predominantly located in Little Canada and Minnetonka, it is certainly a consideration for St. Jude Medical as we grow and develop to expand in Minnesota, and we look forward to continuing to have those discussions in Minnesota. In 2009, St. Jude Medical expanded our campus in Little Canada in particular and built a 180,000 square foot new facility which houses the headquarters for our atrial fibrillation division, as well as is on the campus of our global corporate headquarters, in addition to our international division headquarters. So we have a number of physicians and visitors each year that travel down Highway 36 and onto the Rice Street Bridge, which we would view as an organization as deficient. We also have our heart valve manufacturing division headquarters across Highway 36 that we have employees going back and forth from every single day. And so we'd also point out that really four of our six worldwide operating divisions are based in this corridor here in Ramsey County. We have in our 20-year master plan the capability of expanding this campus where our global headquarters are also located, and we would be hesitant to do so over the next 20 years should the transportation infrastructure in Minnesota not provide adequate for our employees and the multiple visitors that visit us on a daily and annual basis. So we very much appreciate the continuing evolution of this project over the last few years and appreciate very much Senator Wieger's sponsorship, and we appreciate your continued consideration and support.
Thank you. Senator Wieger, this is pretty creative legislation. I live right up there during the legislative session, so I go over that bridge all the time, and it really sucks. This and I drive by the St. Jude Medical Center in the morning, too, so I know right where you're talking about. It's not very often that us Rangers know exactly where a place is in the Twin Cities. We kind of lump you all together, you know, and just say, here you are, but I know exactly where this is, so that's good.
Thank you. We'd like to call on Jim Tolis from Ramsey County now on
Mr.
some
Tolis.
Of the specifics.
Jim Tolis, I'm the project manager for Ramsey County Public Works. I'll keep my comments very brief, but as you've accurately pointed out, the condition of that bridge is extremely poor. It's below the sufficiency rating, so it does require replacement. This project is actually a much larger project than just bridge replacement. It's also a replacement of the entire interchange, reconstruction of a half a mile of Rice Street, reconstruction of four major signalized intersections, all providing connectivity to the Trunk Highway and Interstate system, both for St. Jude's and a number of other important companies in the area. This project has gathered just a unique and overwhelming support from the communities involved, as well as MnDOT and Ramsey County. The cities of Roseville, Maplewood, and Little Canada will have an incredible improvement within their midst with this and allow further development and expansion of area businesses, as well as benefiting commuters. There's just a tremendous amount of congestion and safety problems in that area. This project is fast-tracked and is approaching a 95% design level. That is due out the end of this week. We are well underway in our right-of-way acquisition and have full acquisition by April 1st, putting us in good position to begin this contract and construction effort in the spring of 2010. It is a two-year construction effort, would be completed in fall of 2011, but we're very confident we can get this underway and get these improvements completed.
And Senator Wieger, I'm not 100% sure that we can actually make the link that's in the bill between a bridge and bioscience, but I'll be willing to make that recommendation to the bonding committee. But I know that we also have, I think it's like $75 million in bridge construction and being recommended in the bonding bill. And so you may want to talk to the chairman about where this best fits.
Well, again, Mr. Chair, with the St. Jude Medical Bioscience Campus, we'll provide additional information.
Where the money comes from doesn't really matter that much, but I just wanted to make sure that you know that there's some bonding money that's in bridge construction that's being recommended in the bonding bill, and so that to make sure that if this pot of money doesn't work out for you because there's a real lot of requests in the economic development area, that maybe that's another pot of money that's possible to tap into. So
thank you for the suggestion.
Okay. Are there any questions or comments from any committee members? Okay. Any closing comments?
Thank you very much for the past support in 2008 for the designing, and we look forward to getting it done in a couple of months.
Okay, great. And we'll lay this over then for possible inclusion for a recommendation to the bonding committee.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Murphy. Okay. Senator Murphy, don't take, going last as being a result of you retiring or anything like that. it just kind of happened that way. I apologize. Okay, Senator Murphy, Senate File 46, Red Wing Biosolids Processing Facility.
Mr. Chairman and members, right now in the city of Red Wing, we have a waste facility that produces a Class B biosolid, which gets applied to agricultural properties in some of the
one adjoining town. So,
in Dixie County, it's becoming more and more difficult to find partners to make this Class B product. And that's why
the city of Red Wing.
Look at what the cost benefit would be going from Class B to Class A. Class A is,
you're not going to have a problem finding partners in the agricultural world to spread this material.
With me are all the folks from the
city.
Right to my left is the president of the city council, Ron Schultz, and he'll walk you through kind of what this does and what it doesn't do. I can tell you that the city, the county, partners in Wisconsin, Michigan, all over Duke County, and like I said, over in Wisconsin as well, are looking at this facility to utilize it. And it's a great regional investment.
Okay.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee and say your name for the record, please.
I'm Michael Schultz, Council President for the City of Red Wing. Senator, Honorable Chair, and members of the committee, I'm here to testify about the Red Wing Biosolids Processing Facility. And the individuals with me today are Marshall Hallock, our City's Finance Director, and Bob Stark, our Deputy Director of Public Works for Utilities. Thank you for allowing us this time to testify regarding this important regional renewable energy initiative. The initiative that we've undertaken involves several other local units of government. And it's a construction and operation of a regional biosolids drying facility that would take municipal biosolids and dry them and produce a Class A fertilizer product. Biosolids currently are a byproduct of our wastewater treatment, and historically biosolids have been applied as a fertilizer to agricultural land surrounding the municipalities, and with little or no controversy. However, in the past few weeks, I can share with you through the newspaper articles you're going to see, much controversy has erupted. And we describe some of those difficulties that we're trying to overcome. And interestingly enough, the community has started to say, you need to move to Class A biosolids. This is what they all would like us to do. The city's history has always depended on its proximity to the river. We recognize the importance and support the efforts taken to improve the water quality in the river and Lake Pepin, most notably. This has not come without significant cost, however. The phosphorus removal requirements mandated by the Clean Water Act have increased our biosolids production to the point we no longer have the capacity to manage our solids in a conventional manner and have to resort to more costly off-site facilities. The anticipated implementation of the total maximum daily loads, or TMDLs, for Lake Pepin result in even lower phosphorus limits and further exasperate our management program. Red Wing has proposed to develop and construct a regional biosolids facility on land owned by the city immediately adjacent to our waste-to-energy facility. The proposed facility will utilize renewable steam energy generated by the city's municipal solid waste incinerator to process and dry the wet sludge. The final product will be pathogen-free, dry granular substance, could be utilized as a fertilizer in parks, golf courses, and, of course, also agricultural land. This would reduce the need for commercial chemical or fossil-based fertilizers. And Class A biosolids operations are used across the nation by larger cities and wastewater districts, but not by many smaller, more rural communities. The cost for energy is the major limitation for the option. The energy from the steam would replace the needs for natural gas as the heat source, and the overall volume would be reduced by up to 20-fold to reduce our carbon footprint associated with the hauling. The city is already environmentally conscious, as we have a waste-to-energy facility, and we burn municipal solid waste, and we convert that to heat to steam, and we meet the process and space heating needs of SB Foot Tannery, owned by the Red Wing Shoe Company. The tannery and the city have worked together in cooperative partnership for over 25 years, and those benefits are most remarkable in that what you realize we're one of the last remaining tanneries in the United States. The SB Foot Tannery does not need all the steam we generate, and the excess steam is currently being released into the atmosphere. This excess steam could be used to operate our drying facility. Energy from the steam would replace need for natural gas as the heat source, thus reducing the ever-growing need for our natural resources. The proposed site for a wastewater treatment site, wastewater treatment and waste management development initiatives, has been on tap since 1970. The waste-to-energy facility has been in operation since the early 1980s. And the proposed biosolids has a regional enterprise to it. We have the cities of Kenyon, Lake City, and Prairie Island Indian Committee have already passed resolutions of support. Several other local government units are playing an active role in planning efforts and have expressed strong interest in becoming project participants in the processing facility. The biosolids facility would also coordinate efforts with Western Central Wisconsin biosolids facility located in Ellsworth, Wisconsin. Ellsworth manages the waste from 22 communities and produces a biosolids product that is used as a soil pH amendment. This coordination would provide backup capacity for each other and possibly blending of the products to produce a final product that can meet agricultural or horticultural needs. The list of the benefits of this program is long. The science is sound. The only drawback, of course, is the initial substantial capital investment. And the request for $5 million of state funding will provide Red Wing and all of its potential partners supplemental funding needed to design and construct the facility. Communities have expressed much interest in this. They know it's the right decision to make. They know that we should move forward with this. The residents have started to rally behind us, and finding appropriate funding would make this goal a reality. We have approached Congress in the past. We did get Senator Klobuchar and federal representatives to get $1 million federal appropriation. This past year, it did make it through committee. We are going back out there to ask again. We are going to engage, hopefully, Representative Walz and his office to see if we can pursue this. The southern end of this whole project would include much of his district also, in addition to Congressman Klein's. The proposed project is at a preliminary conceptual design stage, and you know, we would incorporate on-site electrical generation and use the existing heat source to supplement the heat building heating. So that would be incorporated into the final design. Ideally, construction would begin in late 2011, and we're hoping to become operational in 2013. We passed a resolution in 2007 supporting this project. Finally, I would say to you is the community, if you go off and talk to our citizens, they are really saying they want to see this move forward. They want to see us move to Class A biosolids. We live on one of the greatest natural waterways in the United States with Mississippi and Lake Pepin. We do not take that lightly, our responsibility. So in conclusion, the City of Red Wing respectfully requests your support. We thank the committee chair and members, and we'd be happy to entertain any questions from the chair or any other members. Thank you.
So how big is the footprint that's in this picture right here? Let's say your name first.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Bob Stark. I'm with the City of Red Wing. That aerial photograph you have shows our entire waste management campus, the facilities that are illustrated there in addition to the incinerator. We've got a recycling operations, composting. We grind up wood and bring it to St. Paul, and it's used for district heat and energy in St. Paul. Stormwater management is there. Across the road is an ash landfill that takes the ash from our incinerator. And like Mike had mentioned, we're supplying the steam for both process heat and for space heating needs for the SB foot tannery, all off of that site. That total footprint is probably about 9 acres. There's a building there that was part of an industrial wastewater treatment plant. It's identified on that directly in between the waste energy facility and the SB foot. I don't recall the number, but that building is no longer used for that, and that would provide the shell for this new dryer. One downside of this site is that the soils are not very good as far as bearing capacity, so everything that's built there has to be built on pile. By reusing that existing building, we can utilize the foundation, the piling that's already in place.
Okay, and is there any intent to expand the steam line or the steam heat that you're generating here to other buildings or to...
If you got someone that needs some steam, we had some discussions with some other local industries. Most notably, one is a commercial laundry, but the steam that we generate is a low pressure steam. It's not conducive to transporting far distances, and this is probably a mile away. But there are discussions going on. The tannery, when they're in operation, they can take just about all the steam that we generate. It's about 15,000 pounds per hour. Right now they're running, you know, not 24 hours a day, so they're down part of every day, and they also go down every weekend. And so those are the periods of time that would be available for us to do the biosolids drying.
And so if Senator Murphy pulls this one off for you, are you going to name this place after him, or since he's retiring? Or, we could probably put that right in the legislation if you want us to, you know.
You know, I'm tempted. He did ask me to hug it the other day, so I had to hug a jug of sludge. You know?
Senator Murphy's looking for legacy bills now.
What?
Senator Murphy's looking for legacy bills.
You know, you kind of want your name on something before you die. I mean, that's
Well, Mr. Chairman, knowing the type of material that this would be working with, I think it'd be appropriate. So.
I didn't say that. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in all seriousness, this is a great project.
It is.
And I think Mr. Stark, you know, he alluded to it in his final comment there about the operation of this facility, and it's going to be off-peak hours. In other words, that steam's going to continue to supply the SB Foot Tannery, which supplies the Red Wing Shoe Company, which is one of the last union shoe companies in the United States, you know, with processed steam.
Probably one
and
of the last shoe
steam.
Companies, period.
There are some other shoe companies, but they're non-union. Mm-hmm. But, you know, And then operating this facility in those non-peak hours, I mean, it just makes sense because you're capturing that resource, that steam that normally would just be out in the atmosphere. And, you know, we need to do this not only with this facility but with others so that we get, you know, so that the cost-benefit grows on them. And I just, this is one project that needs to happen for
Senator
our community.
Murphy, Senator Murphy, you have one more witness. Do you want to say something?
My name is Marshall Hallock. Again, I'm just here to make these guys look better.
Okay. You're doing a good job.
Thank you.
Could I add
one more
thing?
Absolutely.
Just as a way of demonstrating the city's commitment to this concept of managing our waste in an environmentally manner, I would just like to indicate that we're just nearing completion of about a $6 million addition to our waste-to-energy facility that's called the front-end fuel cleaning. What this would be, instead of the garbage trucks coming in now and dumping, and then we have to burn pretty much whatever they bring in, unless it's obviously something that someone would pull out, this front-end fuel cleaning project would sort by material. It would separate out the cans, the aluminum, the plastic, and the glass, and those go to, you know, recycling streams, so that there's an economic benefit to separating out that material, but even more so, reduces the amount of ash that we generate in the waste energy plant, and so it extends the life of the landfill. You know, so that's a $6 million project. There was a $2 million grant from the state to help us build that, but that demonstrates the commitment of the city towards managing our waste in the manner that makes sense for the long term.
And I think, Mr. Schultz, you mentioned phosphorus earlier. Are you under some kind of mandate to reduce phosphorus? Or I know the Annandale case and Lake Pepin and all that adds in, but are you under some kind of mandate? Or
we are. The mandate hasn't kicked in yet, but it's about to. Go ahead, Bob.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, clarify that.
Our wastewater treatment plant now has a phosphorus limit of 1 part per million. There's all the discussions going on with the TMDLs as part of Lake Pepin. And some of the information that we've seen, although it's not finalized, would take that and, you know, lower that limit. When we went from not having a phosphorus limit to having a phosphorus limit, our sludge production or biosolids production went from about 1.5 million gallons per year up to now 2.5 million gallons per year. And that's the extra material that's causing us the problems.
Okay. All right. All right, good project. Any questions or comments from the committee? Senator Dibble, you haven't been here very much, so you have to have one comment on this project.
No, he doesn't. I'm loving the
term biosolid.
I figured there was something you liked about it. Okay, thank you all very much. Senator Murphy, any final comments on this?
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, all right, thank you all very much. We'll leave this over for possible inclusion and recommendation to the bonding committee. Thank you very much. Yep.
Members, Mr. Chair, we are finished with hearings until the beginning of session. We will be putting together a letter of recommendations to the Capital Investment Committee that will include the total of bills that we have heard in this, not only this pre-session meetings, but also dating back to last session, some of the bonding bills we heard last year.
And I think we have a very important bill coming into this committee on Monday.
Yeah, the first hearing of our committee, which would be Monday the 8th, I believe, we are scheduled to hear Senator Berglund's GAMC fix bill.
Yeah, there's a portion of that bill that's in our under our jurisdiction, and so she has to come through this committee in order for it to get to where it's supposed to go. I forget which part of it is.
I believe they have a fee related to commerce.
MSHA proportion. So this is one of the stops it has to make before we can get the fix done. Okay. Thank you all very much, and good committee hearing and meeting adjourned.
Murphy's
first.
Yeah.